Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
We were bowling, before hour and a half before everything happened.
We was on, lanes 8 and 9. The incident took place around lane 32, 33, totally on the other end of the bowling alley where the concession stand was at.
I don't even know how the incident got started, because at the time I was on the lane bowling, and I just hate to admit it again, but I threw a gutter ball, and I happened to slip at the time, and I was getting up off the ground. I heard somebody say, "Who is that guy in Island State?"
The white guys from Bucosin. If you're from Virginia, you know that some people from Bucosin don't like black people.
Guys would try to, they would mess with him, try to get in his head. And I remember times I had to grab him. I'm like, "Look, man, there ain't gonna be none of this, man."
I said, guy about my height at the time, white guy. So I just, decided to jog him down there.
We was there among friends, and friends protect friends when something's going on.
Everybody knew that Allen had the most potential, so nobody didn't really want to see nothing happen to him.
And you don't need this, man. These guys want to bring you down with them.
I seen a chair swinging, and everything just took over.
The protection came in.
I don't remember exactly how it started. All I remember was just fighting, just everywhere. While it was going on, I stopped and stood there and just looked around everywhere. And it actually scared me. I just was like, "Man, I'm out of here."
First thing, I seen chairs flying, bowling alley pins.
And my friend Dwayne was like, "Let's go, let's go." And somehow or another, we ended up getting up out of there. We all just got in the car and just went and got something to eat because we was hungry.
I remember calling Mo and saying, "Mo, I was at the bowling alley and this would happen." And right then, he'd tell me today, he knew I was in trouble.
From the moment that he told me that, I knew that there were going to be problems. And I knew at that point that we needed a lawyer. I didn't have a lot of money. And number two, I needed an attorney that was a household name. I was working at Hampton University, and Herb Kelly was one of the attorneys that worked for the university. I thought that if I could get Herb Kelly, then this case could quickly go away. I was sadly mistaken.
One day, he told me, the detective called him and told him if I didn't come down there and take these pictures that night, they was going to arrest me off the floor at the Coliseum because we had a game that night.
That was a Hampton Bethel game. That was a game that was going to be attended by more people that had ever come to see a high school basketball game in the state of Virginia.
And they was like, "They're going to come get me off the floor." So I go down there, me and Mo. I looked at the pictures of these guys. I'm 17. These guys are 25 and 30 years old. Plus, people know who I am. I said, "Look, if I don't take these pictures, what's going to happen?" And he said they was going to arrest me and charge me with it. So my lawyer, he said, "If they're going to arrest you, just take the picture." So I took the picture. They waited 8 months, or maybe longer, just so they could try me as an adult.
We were pretty optimistic that the truth was going to come out and put this thing behind us. But it was that first day in court that led me to believe that this thing was far from over, that these white folks was not going to allow this to be over.
And the preliminary hearing, my lawyer asked the detective, did you tell him if he didn't take these pictures, you were gonna arrest him? And it's the lead detective. And the detective said, no, he didn't say that. And right then, me and Mo knew something was gonna happen. You know, this is the lead detective. And he lied right there on the stand.
Aaron Iverson is charged with 3 counts of maiming stemming from a brawl at a bowling alley.
One guy said Iverson threw a chair at him, breaking his glasses. Other people said that Iverson broke their arm. One person said he broke a thumb. And one Pocosin resident said she received a gash in her head.
70-some people in a bowling alley. How do you pick 4 individuals?
Everyone should have been charged for their occurrence. We asked to press charges. It didn't happen.
I'm the only one that everybody in there know.
Had he not been basically a star at Bethel High, had he not been as well known as he is, then he may not have been identified by anyone. He may have been like the other 20 people who were involved that were not charged.
They found out from family members that there was a tape. And actually, I think they thought that would exonerate because they knew that Alan hadn't been directly involved in this.
If you knew what Alan had on that night, you saw him leaving that tape. As everything was still going on and people were still fighting and things were still being thrown, Alan was on his way right out the door, right in front of the camera. But, of course, that never got brought up.
Iverson's on trial for participating in a mob that maimed 3 people last February.
It was portrayed to be like we was acting like a mob of some sort, like we were some organized team to go in and just beat up white people in a bowling alley that night.
By definition, there is no mob. A mob is an assembled group, assembled before they get to the scene for a specific purpose.
It was just a fight between individuals that happened to be blown up into something that it wasn't.
At 17, to be tried as an adult for a fight in a bowling alley, you'd have to think there was a plan. People wanted to make an example of Alan.
I testified and tried to make them understand that he was a good kid and he didn't cause us trouble. And I didn't think anybody listened to me. I didn't think anybody cared. And I came out of there feeling like he doesn't value someone who's taught 25 years as an expert in this field.
I strongly believe that there was a conspiracy to destroy the future of a young, gifted, black person.
This morning, the Bethel High School basketball guard was found guilty of maiming and being a member of a mob.
The verdict was read, and you could just hear a big, oh, just like no time left on the clock. You just missed the free throw to win the game.
We just got, you know, the raw end of the stick.
The question now is, how much time could Iverson spend in jail?
He now faces up to 20 years on each maiming charge.
Up to 60 years on 3 counts of maiming by mob.
I didn't think I was, you know, going to go to jail or anything like that. I didn't even think I would get probation. I was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Me and Dwayne was at Allen's house, and we was just talking, and I was just like, yo, I feel we going to jail, Chuck. He's like, no, we're not going to jail.
We don't deserve to go to jail, man. I'm tired of worrying about what's going to happen and hearing different people tell me what's going to happen.
They do this and that. You should have this and that.
All these people around here trying to tell me what they're doing shit.
Those were kids, man. They had no idea. They didn't know racial prejudice. They didn't know these bigots.
If he asked me, I'm gonna be like, you know, first of all, I wanna thank my family and friends for sticking behind me, people in the Swiss program. I wanna thank all the little kids. Then again, I want to apologize to my family and friends.
They did not know that these people were about to lynch their ass. These people were about to railroad you.
If I would have did all the stuff like he said, you know, if I would have came with y'all, shit like that, you know what I'm saying, the real deal, came with y'all, hit the girl in the head with the chair, hit him, you know what I'm saying, I don't understand why this shit happened. But you know damn well I ain't come with y'all niggas, man.
Nah, I really thought I was being railroaded.
Man, she can ruin our whole everybody's life.
This could turn us to hardcore criminals.
That judge can tear 4 black people down right now, just like that, if you want to. That white motherfucker got me wrong.
Security was very tight here this morning at Hampton Circuit Court. Several deputies and police were on guard.
You seen all the police they had in the courtroom.
And I knew right then what was about to happen.
Only Iverson had anything to say before sentencing.
I did feel bad for what happened to the people that night and before now. I don't want that to happen to nobody in this situation.
The facts involving Robert Wilkes. The court sentences you to serve a term of 5 years in prison.
Judge Nelson Overton sentenced Iverson to 15 years behind bars, but suspended all but five. His co-defendant, Michael Simmons, received 17 and a half years, and he suspended all but five of that as well.
10 years suspended for an incident like that, you know, when people do a lot worse.
The air just totally went out of the courtroom, and then just everybody began to look around. Some people was crying. But it was just real weird and awkward. It just didn't seem like a real life story right now. Didn't seem real at all.
I never thought I'd see the day where adults would do something so drastically wrong to kids.
It's pretty sad.
It was a nightmare. You know, it was really a nightmare.
Ann Iverson says she'd like to see her son finish high school.
I don't want him to be in jail that long. I want him to get out and I want him to go to school.
I think they can be rehabilitated in jail also. I mean, there are programs available. There's a GED program there. Iverson could finish his education. They have recreational facilities. I don't think he'd be any worse off.
I just couldn't believe that people were this mean.
The judge decided that he would not grant a bond pending the appeal at this point because he wanted them, very frankly, to go ahead and to start accumulating credit for the time that they would go ahead and serve.
In all the years that I've been doing this, the only defendants that are not given a bond are capital murderers. Capital murderers, that's people that are going to go to the electric chair.
That was true injustice. And that's why it hurt so much, because it was truly unjust.
I think the guy got what he deserved, and I hope he does every bit of time that he's given.
He was unjustly tried and convicted and sentenced to time in a prison facility for grown men.
I remember telling my grandma, like, Nana, if I didn't do what these people said I did, why is God letting this happen to me? And she told me, and I never did it since then, never questioned God. So much taken away from me. I think I just learned so much from it. You know, it taught me a lot at an early age.
Mr. Iverson would be awakened at 4 o'clock. He would shower and shave or whatever he needed to do to prepare for that day. This is a working camp. You are here to work. And we cut all the grass, 27 miles, anything green and is not moving, we cut it.
He used to kill me, man. You know, I might have to be up at 6. He'd come waking me up at 4 in the morning.
I would come in and he knew it would irritate me. He would sing a cop killer song. I put my life on the line for anybody here, and to belittle that killing of a police officer, it made me think just another punk from the streets.
He made it extremely hard for me.
People would pass notes to him saying that I wish you were dead. I hope your black ass rot in prison. The jailers would bring him a doll with a noose, and written on that doll was Allen Iverson.
I had lawyers every single day that I was talking to them. They were telling me that you're getting out tomorrow. Then tomorrow will come, and they say you're getting out tomorrow. I remember just being frustrated, and one of my friends came up. And he said some of the best advice that someone could ever give me. You're not getting out of here. So stop thinking about it and do what you got to do, handle what you got to handle, and get back to what you love to do. It made it so much easier for me to do the time because I had in my mind that I wasn't going nowhere.
Hampton residents have formed what they call the Swift Legal Defense Fund. There was a very vocal support for those kids. It didn't do any good, but there were marches.
Mr. Iverson received a sack load of mail by himself. Ladies were sending him their unmentionables, and they were sending him money. They were sending him gifts. Interviews were requested. I know Mr. Tom Brokaw was allowed to interview him.
Tonight we have the story of what has happened to a young man who was headed for a $1 million future, but now he's in jail. It was one of those classic cases. Here's a kid with the gift of the gods as an athlete. And a community where they'd still not worked out all the racial issues, obviously.
I prepared myself for the worst. If I had to do this whole time here, I just had to deal with it.
I thought the sentence was surprisingly harsh. And I think that our story had something to do with people looking at the case in a slightly different way because it got national attention.
I got a lot of love for NBC, Tom Brokaw. I mean, he did a lot for me, and I appreciate him. I owe a lot to him for that.
Allen Iverson is facing freedom tonight for the first time in months.
The high school standout has been handed conditional clemency by Governor Doug Wilder.
Our governor pardoned Allen. You know, his rule was he couldn't play sports. Who cared? He could go to school.
I think it was a relief for the officers because the news media would be gone. The calls would be gone. All the mail that we received would be gone. And hopefully no more women's underwear.
How do you feel, Alan?
Hey.
I'm fine. Are you glad it's over?
Governor Wilder gave me another shot at life. You know, if it wasn't for his signature, I might not be here.
As for the other three young men, Governor Wilder is considering clemency for them as well. Ed?
We was out and there was hugs and dapping each other up and let's go to the mall. I need some new clothes.
Context of white supremacy. I almost need like 20 seconds just to compose myself. That is such a powerful documentary. Allen Iverson, the documentary that they did, it's a part of the ESPN 30 for 30 series. And the whole documentary is pretty much about that incident and his childhood and growing up in Virginia on the whole, but I mean racism, Virginia, Allen, that's the whole documentary done by a white man, of course. It's amazing, but with everything that, you know, was conveyed in that piece to end with, let's go to the mall, like, man, making improvements with the way that we invest our time and energy as victims of racism, that is definitely high on the priority list of things to do. Dr. Curry, if you are with us, and I just missed your line, just press *6. I'll know you're there. The only reason I was playing that clip was I was looking out for Dr. Curry. I wasn't sure if he had dialed in, and so I was trying to wait to give him a little extra time, but that is such an amazing audio segment. I was just listening intent. I've seen the documentary, like, several times, and I've heard that clip, I don't know, more than five times, I think, at this point. It is amazing. It is absolutely amazing. Dr. Curry, I will drop him another message and see if we cross signals or what have you to get him in. I know folks always appreciate hearing his commentary, and there's so many things to discuss. Just quickly, some of the things that stood out related to current events. He didn't get a bond. A black teenager accused of mob violence against white people didn't get a bond. Daniel Holtzclaw is facing 36 counts of sexual terrorism, exclusively targeting black females, at least 13 black females, and he got a bond. Not only did he get a bond, he violated the conditions of his bond, and he got a do-over. Black lives matter. Black lives matter. So, I mean, wow. And I mean, we have talked about that before on the program in terms of the racism, white supremacy, about who gets a bond, how much is your bond, all of that. Even in the case of James Craig Anderson in Mississippi, where the gang, talk about mob violence, they got video of a white mob of white females and white males, teens. They ran, they yelled white power, they beat the guy, they got in their truck, and then they ran him over. This was 2011 in Mississippi. They ran him over on camera, all of this on camera. Daryl Deadman, that's one of the little white savages, race soldiers that participated in this act of terroristic murder, white terroristic murder. His bond, I think, was something like absurd. It was like $50,000. That was the initial price that they set for his bond. And then it got reviewed when they got more of the evidence. Like, oh, wait a minute. These looks like they killed a nigger on camera. We might have to increase. I mean, total disgrace. But yeah, no bond for Allen Iverson. And the others, it's not just him. Most of the ESPN 30 for 30 documentaries are like that. Not that, hey, Dr. Welsing was just here. Reading is more important than watching television. That said, most of the ESPN 30 for 30 documentaries are about racism. Oh my gosh, Ghosts of Ole Miss, incredible. That is probably one of the best five films that I have seen. I could probably say period, just on the basis of a film. It is incredible. White people killing other white people because one student, James Meredith, wanted to go to school. It is a veteran, not just a student, a veteran, a black veteran wanted to go to school. And you had white people killing other white people. It is amazing. I would definitely talk about dedication. White people took turns bouncing a basketball over the room of James Meredith in 24-hour shifts and confesses, admits, yes, we did this. I participated in doing this. It is amazing. But most of them are about racism. Like they're talking about, you know, if you're going to be talking about athletics over the last 30 years or so, you're going to be talking about a lot of black people. And how can you talk about any black person and not talk about racism? So the vast majority, they are amazing. And no, that is something to watch. If you got to watch television, you can learn a lot. And I suspect if you have younger black people, that might be a way to get them to think about race. Man, if they watched or appreciated Allen Iverson, oh my God, like you were that close to not even knowing his name, like because of racism, white. I think you could maybe get, you know, a discussion going maybe on that one. Doug Wilder. Wow. Man, when I played the clip, I think it was maybe a month ago, because he just has a biography about, you know, his life, racism, the Virginia State song being Take Me Back to Old Virginia. This, like, anyway, it's amazing. But about racism, like, man, Allen Iverson should be, I don't know if that's in the book, like, I haven't read it yet, but I definitely want to read it. Man, I don't know if that's Allen Iverson should be like writing the foreword. Anything I could do to help, I will be out on the book tour. I mean, that is amazing. I would love to hear, because he shares some of the notes that he got from angry racists when he changed the racist state song. And I think he saw the state guard, like their uniforms, I think had the Confederate flag on it. And I think he got that removed too. And he talks about some of the really racist, terroristic mail that he got when he did these things. He saved them. He has them archived, Doug Wilder. And he shares some of, oh my gosh, I wish I hope he did the same for the content that he got about Allen Iverson, because I know he had some white people who were furious about, you know, him releasing this back into society. And I think there's at least one other incident. I would need confirmation. I could be incorrect, but I seem to remember there were white college students who were arrested for like drug violations, possible some alcohol violations, criminal activity. And he went ahead with the case, and they were furious. Like, what? You're going to ruin these white children's lives? Are you much like they sound now, talking about we need to reform the drug war, and oh man, we've got this heroin problem. And look, they did a whole special on 60 Minutes last week just about white people and their drug problem. And oh man, this is terrible. We need that. Look at this. You don't, Becky, Rick, anyway, I would definitely, Doug Wilder, huge fan, read the book, it just came out, that's why I played the segment. Allen Iverson should be his biggest fan. Like, anything that I can do for Doug Wilder, I am there. The Power of Journalism, Tom Brokaw, the segment where he was talking about them covering his story and what happened, man, they could do that every day. That even reminded me when Mr. Fuller talked about how white people, they can, because they dominate, they can shift and focus attention as they choose. Like, that happens to black people daily, hourly. Like, what? That's not news. That happens all the time to black. They could be doing that every day, but it just happens. Oh, okay, we might want to see this nigga play basketball. Oh, okay, maybe we'll get him out. The rest of you, you know. You know, we'll deal with you when we deal with you. Get back to work. Mow the grass. Mow the grouse. Scotty Reed. I was slavery. Total plantation. Get over there. Anything that's green, you can. Like, total plantation in Virginia. Amazing. And Gospel According to Mac. That's the last thing I was going to say. Another fantastic documentary. All about racism, Thomas in New York. He might be on the, I guess I should share, because that was, you know, he recommended checking that one out, and I think he might be here. If you want to explain, I guess if you're in a quiet place, if you are so inclined, if you would like to share why you encouraged the viewing of The Gospel According to Mac, and what that has to do with the situation in Missouri. If you want to explain, feel free, sir. Maybe you muted yourself. We're not hearing you.
Greetings to all. I'm so angry I missed yesterday, so I mean, I had something come up at the last minute, and I was, but I listened to it, and it was, the guy did a great job, man. That Gospel According to Mac, I'll put it in perspective of this Missouri situation, because I'm looking at this coach standing behind his players, and I'm saying, man, in big-time college football, this dude is recruiting.
Oh, I think you dropped out. Think you dropped out, sir. Let's see. Oh, hold that thought. I think we have Dr. Curry. Right on. Just making sure we had the new number, and I sent it to him. That's why I said I didn't know if we crossed signals. Didn't know if he had the information or no. But always a pleasure. I know one of guest folks really look forward to hearing from and having on the program. I think this is his sixth visit. Always great. He's one of the few folks, if you pay attention down through the years, one of the very few folks who I think has just fundamental truth about, let's be honest, about the problems that we are facing. White people are not, cannot be ignorant about racism. I mean, it just does not make sense. Always appreciate hearing his opinions on racism, white supremacy. He's in the Department of Philosophy at the University of Texas A&M. His various fields of philosophy, his interests, research study, philosophy, jurisprudence, Africana studies, and gender studies. There's so many things that have been happening in the news right now. Just a pleasure to get his thoughts on some of the current events. Dr. Tommy Curry. Dr. Curry, let's see if I got him. Dr. Curry, are you with us, sir?
Yes, sir, I am.
Outstanding. Glad you got the updated number. I thought about that today, like we have a new number. Want to make sure.
I was trying to get through on the old one.
Right on. Always a pleasure to hear from you, sir. Anything that you think folks should know about you? I know some people, this is their first time hearing from you.
You know, there's so much to tell. I'm an associate professor of philosophy, affiliate professor of black studies at Texas A&M University. A lot of my work deals with anti-colonialism, the permanence of racism, and black men and boys. So I try to research what I take to be the structural impediments to black life through anti-black racism and the particular subordinate racial and economic positions of black males in this country.
Outstanding. I'm going to try to cover as much as possible and give people a chance to get questions in as well. I know they will have some things they'll want to hear your views on. To start, it was about a year ago you were on the program. You've been with us since, but I was asking you, you are a parent? You are a father?
I am. I have two little girls, yes.
Exactly. And we were talking about things to do, things not to do as a parent. How has that evolved over the year? They're getting older. Just what are you all doing now on that front as black parents in a system of racism, white supremacy?
Well, I mean, the biggest thing, you know, my oldest daughter started kindergarten, and because we're in a conservative state, we're trying to inculcate in her just the most positive stories we can about little black girls and black women. So we constantly read her stories where black girls are the center focus. I think I mentioned last time the wonderful book we found about the girl with the magic Afro Puffs. Since then, we've done ballet, gymnastics, you know, something that shows her as kind of an actional, you know, black female character and being, and she really translates those things. You know, we've been extremely pleased. They've started taking, you know, the children to libraries, and she's always picking out books with black characters, especially black female characters. So we feel like, you know, what we're doing has some positive effect. You know, my little three-year-old, you know, it's the same way, she reads books with her sister. So we're pretty happy in terms of the self-esteem and self-conceptualizations that we're giving the children.
Wow, that is awesome. That is awesome. Wow. It's a book literature to recommend. Did you all, like, I guess at what point did you all start planning what's our educational plan going to be for our mm-hmm. children? Like, at what point? And just kind of what did that look like, putting that plan together?
Well, as soon as I found out we were having girls, you know, I was already on top of that. You know, when she was a baby, I was reading her, you know, I read her, like, stories of Ida B. Wells and, you know, tell her stories of, you know, Frances E. W. Harper, you know. So, I mean, that's just me. I thought those were good bedtime stories for some reason. And we, you know, filled her room up with pictures of black girls. So, you know, I think it's just a self-conscious decision. I mean, when you look at, you know, all the data and all the information around how black people are constantly beat down by systems of white supremacy and anti-blackness, and you know specifically how black women suffer under these kinds of oppressions, like I've always said, there, you know, there's anti-black racism, and it affects black men and black women differently. So you try to do things like self-esteem, things that show that her that she can actually do anything regardless of what white people may say, regardless of what the education may say, system may say. So, you know, my wife and I decided this well before she was born.
Wow. Like, I guess to make it more concrete, like, what steps have you put in place to eliminate to the best that you can the likelihood of what Officer Ben Fields did to happening to either of your daughters?
Well, I mean, you know, that's a very scary thing. After we saw that, my wife and I had a very serious conversation about whether or not we need to take them out of public schools. Again, you know, we're in Texas. It's a place where I could get shot any random time, you know, if I'm stopped. And it's a place where black women can be assaulted by any white person at any time of day. We understand this vulnerability. We've kind of concretely talked to the teacher of her kindergarten class, who happens to be a black woman, and we've expressed our concerns. And they've assured us that they don't have those types of armed people. She's in elementary school, so there's not any armed guards or security guards in the facility, in the school at this point. So, you know, I mean, I think the best that a parent can do, given those circumstances, is to make sure that you're involved and make sure that your children aren't policed. Now, in cases where we live in urban institutions or you're from an urban city where you know that there is a militarized police force in your schools and you may not have the economic means to do so, that means that, you know, your parents have to be active. They have to make sure that they have a voice both politically and institutionally within the school to make sure that if something like that did happen, that there would be, you know, things like lawsuits, firings. You know, they would have to try to deter it, right? And unfortunately, given the availability and just kind of the mass violence against black men and boys, as well as women and girls, you know, black people are in a precarious position. You know, it's something that has now become synonymous with just being black in America.
Wow. Do they have, like, any type of security resource officers in your children's school?
They don't. Okay. They don't. Which is something that we're pretty happy about.
Hmm. Wow.
So, because it goes through from K to 5, so there is no security presence in it.
Okay. I have seen some, like, 5 and 6-year-olds handcuffed recently. Like, they are...
Yeah, that's... Right. And we've been on top of that, right? We've been asked to be called first.
Okay.
You know, before anything like that happens.
Okay. Do they, like, have statistics on, like, suspensions and that sort of thing in the school to make sure that they're tracking that, you know, any disparities in disciplinary action?
Not so much here. Everything is usually handled by my daughter's in kindergarten, so
right.
This may change as she gets in older in more advanced grades. But everything seems to be handled first by the teacher, and then from the teacher, if the child misbehaves, they call the parent. And then they decide what to do in conversation with the parent. So we like that system. And once that was explained to us, we felt much better about keeping her there rather than moving her.
Okay. Yeah, these are the type of, I mean, this is like vital, just, you know, these type of conversations, you know, the parents having these sorts of discussions, talking with your children. I mean, this is vital, right?
No, it is. It is. And, you know, it's like I said last time, I think that one of the biggest mistakes that we make when we try to deal with white supremacy is that we externalize it, right? We look at white supremacy as something that's outside of us and then tries to impose itself on us, rather than looking at the myriad of ways that we both internalize white supremacy or the anti-blackness of white supremacy and the kind of care we need to take in our homes to try to make sure that our children have some kind of psychological coping mechanism and adjustments to what we know exists in regular society. And that's just never part of the conversation. Mental health, conflict resolution, parenting, discipline, these are not the conversations that we have amongst ourselves, even as scholars. And I think that's to the detriment of black people, you know, throughout the country. It's just a woefully overlooked conversation.
Ashe. Leading beautifully to my next question. And this is something you've been with us at least 6 times now. And I think I ask this almost every program. And the reason is because I think it's just a fundamental error, right, in terms of just looking at some of the things that we're doing and trying to make improvements in ultimately solving this problem, racism, white supremacy. The notion, the rhetoric that white people are ignorant about racism. We frequently have white people on the program, and we have one of our listeners, she's in Michigan. She, I think almost every time she'll ask the white person, who do you think is more confused about racism? I think every single white person ever that we've had on the program says, oh yeah, white people are way more confused. Like they don't know. What are some of the cliches? They don't have to think about it. White is just, you know, neutral. So you don't have a race. Everybody else has a race. It doesn't impact them, so they don't have to see. I mean, the cliches just keep coming and coming and coming. And the reason that I emphasize this is because I think if we have a system of racism, white supremacy, this is a global problem impacting all black people of all ages everywhere in the world. If we're thinking that this is happening because white people are just not informed, I think we're not going to come to a correct solution about this problem, as opposed to just being honest and saying, not only are they informed, they are much more informed than even we are. Your Absolutely. Response?
No, I agree. You know, one of the, again, you have to understand that the privileged discourse, the idea of ignorance, is a way for largely upper middle class blacks to maintain the idea that whites are still rational, virtuous, and reasonable. This is not how poor and working class black people experience white supremacy. In other words, the reason that we're able to say white privilege exists and you don't know is that it gives a function to the relationship that educated middle class black people have to white people. So there's a way in which interracial contact can now be justified as legitimate because there's a way in which it now improves the condition of white people. This really restates what the Warren Court thought they were doing in Brown v. Board of Education. The Warren Court, off the back of contact theory, or rather, this other way, the Warren Court made a decision, Denounce Court made contact theory. And the idea was that, look, if whites are in contact with blacks, then that socializes white people to be more accepting of black culture and the position that black people have in society. White privilege is just a restating of that, you know, long disproven, or I should say long complicated narrative that if black people interact with white people, then somehow white people become better people. The idea of privilege discourse simply allows white people to give up their privilege so that they can now maintain friendly relationships, or what they now call allyship, with white people so that it can be to the benefit of the people that's involved. Specifically, we see this now in terms of scholars who are advanced in certain positions because they reduce everything now to discourse. People like Tim Wise, who I know you've had on the show several times, is able to maintain a kind of public persona as a radical because he constantly points out white privilege and male privilege and these other privileges. And I actually had a brief conversation with him when he was interviewed on Our Common Ground with Ms. Graham. And one of the things that I asked him was that, listen, if your argument is that males enjoy male privilege in the function of being male, then how do you truly understand the system of white supremacy that is functionally and empirically, right, denied manhood and humanity to black men and brown men, right? How do you explain this alleged privilege that subordinated racial and ethnic groups of men have within a white supremacist and patriarchal society, if your analysis simply asserts, without any consideration of their situation or the history of oppression, that they are, in fact, subject to sexual abuse, rape, as I've talked about on the program before, and, you know, ultimately, the final end of death. You know, these things seem ridiculous to me. That if you're going to assert that people have privilege simply based on their identities and bodies, you don't have to know anything about the real world. And I think this is what reducing everything to privilege discourse and acknowledgement actually does. It allows us to make up things about the world without having to actually know anything about the world. You can say, well, there's a black man who's heterosexual. He's privileged over these other groups of people who may be homosexual or trans, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not an empirical study of that condition. That same person could live, not have education, be unemployed, have a terminal disease. It just requires you to make up things. And then everybody buys into this because this is the dominant liberal discourse, similar to how integrationism was, you know, several decades ago.
Context of white supremacy. Some of our listeners have critiqued and they have asked us to go back. We used to do a lot of encouraging our guests. If you could please, you could lower the vocabulary level. Just I want to make sure folks who don't have as much education that they can still understand some of the real important points that you're making. The other one is I wanted to just on the ignorance aspect of it. I look at incidents just to make it with current events because I definitely want to get your feedback. I've even heard that in connection to what's happening with Missouri right now. Protests, right. Folks, the hunger strike with the graduate student, and then it spreads the black football players on the team decide that they're not going to play. Tim Wolf, the president, former president, he steps down. The chancellor also, he's supposed to be stepping down after the end of the year. And this is ongoing, very fluid situation. But with some of the incidents within that, I think they had the one incident where the, I think it was Tim Wolf, where they were talking, he was having a discussion with some of the black students, and he said that, I think they asked him, what is systemic racism or systemic oppression? And he said, it's when you believe that you don't have the same opportunities or that you're being oppressed. And they were like, you know, that is ridiculous. And people were saying, see, he's just not aware. He's not informed. He's ignorant. He just, as though if we just can get him to the white privilege conference, now he will understand and he won't say that anymore. And that will correct his ignorance of racism. Even the situation at Yale, because they're connected, same thing, racism college campus, where they were saying that there was a swastika painted on a college dorm room in feces. And they said that this person, literally, this person needs training to understand that this is, you know, like racist, terroristic behavior. You shouldn't do that. I mean, literally, I heard that today. This was described as an error. This person just needs training. I'm not even connecting the logic. Can you respond to that?
You know, it's the same. It's the same excuses we're constantly finding when we try to have a real conversation about racism in this country, right? The idea is that white people start from a blank slate, that despite their history, despite the actual actions and atrocities that have been committed historically, that somehow this generation of white people, even if they're 30, 40, or 50 years old, simply have no recollection or memory of racism. And it puts the burden, as I've said before, on the backs of oppressed people, black, brown, indigenous people, to somehow educate people who benefit from racist structures, to somehow become cognizant of the fact that they're at the top of a racist hierarchy. This makes no sense to me. I mean, think about it. You know, as I said before, it's funny how racial ignorance only works in one direction, right? That white people are always ignorant of racism, but it only tends towards them doing racist acts. They never make the mistake of doing something that's anti-racist. It's just all towards one final end, which is the benefit of them, which happens to be racial stereotypes, not acting against very, you know, virulent forms of racism, not, you know, putting up nooses. All these things are by accident, right? And, you know, this is what I think is just nonsensical about how we explain this. I think this is one of the problems, not only with our current intersectional discourse, but also with the way that we talk about things like Black Lives Matter. All these become huge problems when we're trying to actually solve the concrete problem of racism.
Wow. I want to read a segment. This is a draft, one of the newer papers that you've written, The Cries of the Unheard, State Violence, Black Bodies, and Martin Luther King's Black Power, with you and Darius D. Hills, Rice University. I'm scrolling down. I'm starting the segment where you're talking about womanist religious thought and Martin Luther King Jr. on black bodies. You write, most black religious scholars agree with the notion that the black body is under siege. And while there are several ways of interpreting body, theoretically and methodologically, for our purposes, we view the body as a material reality, biochemically constituted and socially constructed. Restated, critical to our interpretation of body is how black bodies are marked and characterized within American social relations with deadly consequences. I'm skipping down a little bit, same page. The body has typically been viewed with fear, scorn, and suspicion from the time of antiquity into the present day. Skipping down just last portion in Stand Your Ground, Black Bodies and the Justice of God, Kelly Brown Douglas argues that black bodies are guilty bodies in American religious thought through a deadly, discursive, and social political regime premised upon the narrative of white Anglo-Saxon exceptionalism and the lauding of the white bodies and spaces as cherished property. Can you explain that? And maybe even if you could relate it to, I don't know if you've been following, but to me, the rape case involving Daniel Holtzclaw, everything that I just read applied to what's happening with that case.
Yeah. Well, you know, let me give credit to my co-author. You know, he did some serious work on that section, and, you know, I'm very happy that we were able to get that publication together. I think there's a few things here. The first is black bodies, blackness, right? Those bodies that when we see them in society, we can identify them as black. That means that it comes with certain expectations and assumptions. And some of those expectations and assumptions are not simply the kind of solidarity we feel amongst ourselves as black people, that's another black person. But sometimes those expectations or assumptions also give us a certain kind of vulnerability, where we believe, for example, that if we see a black man that he's dangerous or he's a criminal. It's these kinds of socialized, the kinds of ideas and stereotypes that are even in black people's heads that we get from a racist society. So when we're talking about bodies that are marked in a certain way next to white bodies, what we're saying is that black bodies are in fact marked as deviant, criminal, dangerous by white bodies, by white society. And what that enables white society to ultimately do is execute those bodies, commit crimes against those bodies, to brutalize those bodies such that it's viewed as legitimate. An example of that would be the mass killings that we see in this society of black men. Because we think these black men are dangerous, we see it as legitimate and necessary, or as the cops like to call it, justifiable, right, that these men are killed because people believe fundamentally that black men are dangerous and out to hurt everyone else. So the cops merely activate a racist stereotype that's largely shared by the rest of society, right? And I think this is exactly what happens when we, on the flip side, too, you know, not making rape exclusively a violence against women, but nonetheless recognizing that, you know, in the Hostclaw case, that this is exactly what's happening, right? That a white man is being accused of raping, what is it, 6 or 7 black women at this point, and you have an all-white jury. So the question now becomes whether or not this all-white jury actually sees black women who they may assume are naturally promiscuous or who they don't see as fully human or virtuous, are they in fact, right, being raped by this white cop? I think that this is the predicament that we have when we're looking at racism. And this is not a predicament that's just based on something like ignorance. This is something that is recognized as the vulnerability of black bodies. So the same way that a white cop, and this happens all the time in Stop and Frisk, that white cops can sodomize and rape black males, in the same way that white cops can rape black women during these stops, this shows a vulnerability because society as a whole doesn't care about black people. In other words, they're not going to condemn the white life, no matter how violent or atrocious his acts are against black people, and value black people above white people. It's going to suggest that the society as a whole is going to suggest that black life is ultimately inferior and in some way called for this violence to happen, be it rape, be it murder, or be it just brutality. And we see this all the time, where we have cops on videotape, like Eric Garner, being, you know, cops killing Eric Garner. We see this all the time with, you know, the Sam DuBose case, right, in Cincinnati. I mean, you know, the man is in a seatbelt, shot in the head. These are the things that we see happen. And as I mentioned before, one of the most infuriating aspects of this is that it's the kind of grotesque nature that we can look at a person and know that this person forced other people, other women, other black women, to have sexual relations, oral sex, and people somehow believe that that would be consensual, despite his position of power, right? This is the problem. This is what's going on. Right, that we make black people suffer and invisible because we overrepresent black people as dangerous and not human. And this is the fundamental problem of racism. When we talk about racism as attitudes, we miss this fundamental aspect of history. See, this is not random. This is what racism has always done. It's always included the sexual violence. It's always included the rape and molestation. It's always included those aspects of brutality against black people. So when you have these middle and upper class intellectuals trying to frame racism as a misunderstanding and a naive take on the part of white people, it's excluding the brutality of violence that's actually happening to the poor and working class black folks across the country and really across the world.
Context of white supremacy. I wanted to ask, number one, I think in the Holtzclaw case, it's at least 13 black females, and they think
13, wow.
Yeah, and they think some of the victims probably have not come forward because they're intimidated or they don't want to be branded as a whore and a crackhead and everything else that they've, the way that they've blasted these victims. But the other thing that I wanted to talk about, the number one, the timing, this case, the jury, as you already stated, all white jury, eight white men,
right,
four white females, that came out the same day as the Supreme Court, and they're looking at the pattern of black jurors being excluded. And,
yeah,
you know, is this an act of racism, and how can we correct this, or, you know, what they're going to decide on that. I think that happened the same day. The other aspect, and I was talking about this when we were trying to get you the information for the new number, Daniel Holtzclaw, his bond was initially $5 million.
Mm-hmm.
The attorney, or the judge, excuse me, the same judge that's hearing the case now, he reduced his bond to $500,000, and he was able to get bond and be on house arrest.
Wow.
Not only did that happen, he violated his bond, and he went to the doctor and didn't alert his parole officer. So he got like 14 days in jail, and then he was back on house arrest. They gave him a do-over. He violated his bond again. The monitor was off, but he said he allowed the battery to run out. And so he was like off the grid for like, I think, a 7-hour period. And at that point, the bond company revoked his bond. And so then he had to go back to jail. And I was talking about just looking at, you know, what happens to black people in this instance. Man, I mean, you could point to Khalif Browder even. He couldn't get out of jail because of the bond. Just if you could talk about that aspect as well.
Yeah, let me start here. Like, you know, when I first heard about this case, I try to stay abreast of everything. You know, I heard that, you know, there was some indecent exposure as well as rape. And I think that one of the reasons that society has not taken this seriously is because when black women are raped, especially by white men, there is still the neo-slave ideology, which holds that it's not really rape, right? So that's the first thing that I think is important. And the second thing I think is important about the Bell issue is that society doesn't think that, I don't think that society thinks white male rapists are really criminals. I think that, especially when they rape black women, I think that the way that rape culture exists in this country is to suggest that rape matters only when it's practiced against white women or committed by racialized men. And the exemption of that, of course, is that when white women rape racialized men or when white men rape racialized women, there is not a call from the population, from the public, as if that represents a danger or a threat, because historically that's how it's always been, right? It's always been that idea. It's always been the notion that raping lower peoples, inferior peoples, is not really rape at all, because there's no humanity that these people possess that can actually be violated. And this is something that I think requires a lot of study and serious reflection in terms of how we look at the functions of racism. One of the things we do today is we separate what we take racism to be and that of sexism. And when many people, even popular commentators, look at this case, they see it as an issue of sexism, or racism and sexism, this kind of power between him as male and him as white. But that kind of misconstrues what's going on. It doesn't see that the history of racism is about complete subjugation. And part of that complete subjugation is that men and women are raped. And in this case, the reason that a white man is able to rape so many black women is because there's no penalty for the white male rapist, because he is in fact contributing to maintaining the order of society, which is the debasement and the divestment of blackness to whiteness. So unless we understand this kind of hierarchy of whites at the top because of their racial superiority or their alleged racial superiority of blacks at the bottom, then I think we miss the different techniques that are used to keep people there, right? And by making this an issue of, well, how many jurors are selected, how many are black, et cetera. It gives the pretense that the system is set up to work out for black people in the first place. And that's not the case. The reason that black jurors, specifically black men, were excluded from that jury is because black men are usually less sympathetic to white men in this country, especially when you're talking about black women. So that's not an accident, given that that's how the court system operates. Right, because imagine if this was flipped. Imagine if a black cop had raped, you know, 7, 13, white women. This would be over immediately. The world would be in fire, in flames. Everyone would ignite. We know what would result from that kind of situation. This case is different because it fits the pattern of subjugation, and I think that that's something that's always missed. When we have commentators that talk about this, the commentary is always about what went wrong. Right, what went wrong in this system such that they did not see these women as human, instead of understanding that this system is not built that way. And this is why you get the liberal talk about privilege and change, the liberal considerations of, oh, the bell should have been higher, etc., instead of understanding that the system is not going to work in a way that allows this individual to actually be punished. Because if he's punished in this way, then it suggests that the history by which this has happened also needs to be reconciled with. And that's not something that America is willing to do.
Just quickly putting into context some of your commentary, I thought of the Duke lacrosse case, Crystal Mangum, who
yeah.
is now in greater confinement. I thought Tawana Brawley. I thought Joan Little and Darren Manning, who I know you've written about, the 16-year-old in Pennsylvania
yeah.
who had his testicles ruptured. One of the things that came out of this was directly related to this. The Associated Press, they did a big report about how widespread this is. This is not isolated. This is a product, a long-running product of racism, white supremacy, and terrorizing and sexually terrorizing black people, males and females. And they did this big write-up in the AP, and they were talking about this case and the many other instances of how these officers are able to function as predators and have been doing
mm-hmm.
so for quite some time. And they did include that this happens to both males and females, and they had a big section about how this officer was terrorizing, I think it was like 20, and they said specifically non-white males, and telling them, you know, you're going to let me do whatever I want, sexually violate you, or, you know, we're going to make a lot of trouble for you. And I just thought, wow, like, that is a man I thought of you, where you regularly say this is not something that we should exclusively think just happens to females. They do this across the board, even Darren Manning, children.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and there was just a recent case at the University of Notre Dame.
Go ahead. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, I mean, these are the types of things that happen. I mean, you know, a young black boy was made to have sex with the academic tutor's daughter. You know, I mean, what do you say about this? You know, and this is what I'm constantly pushing on people, is that We have conceptualizations of things that are just not real. We want to argue with each other about categories like race versus sexism, and then we have all this evidence. You know, I mean, on my Facebook page, I post daily about white women or black women who are convicted for the sexual assault or molestation of young black males or teenage black males. This is a real problem in this society that doesn't get any attention because it's so enormously refutes the ideologies that we have about rape and rape culture in the United States. And one of the things, again, that I keep trying to stress to people is that this is not about identity politics. This is not about creating a discourse that can negotiate with white people. It's about understanding the history of exploitation such that we understand the origin in colonial and slave structures that have used sexual exploitation as a means of control and domination, the ways that dynamic has changed with certain political movements by white women like in Jim Crow, the rise of the WKKK and feminism, and the way that we've erased that because of the need for us to socially and economically mobilize with the structures of white supremacy. These things have continued to happen. The only difference now is whereas working and poor blacks in the past have taken a lead in our politics, today we have people that are suggesting to us that there's no need for that, that we'll let the bourgeois handle it, and that's why these issues don't come to the forefront of our discussions.
Context of white supremacy. Dr. Tommy Curry, if you have questions, feel free to chime in. The number 641-715-3640. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you have a question. I know I was super looking forward to getting your thoughts. There has been so much attention on the recent data that suggested that the rates of death for middle-aged whites, particularly middle-aged whites with less education, especially white males, that their rates of death are increasing. And they were like, just, wow, what is happening? What is going on? And not going back to what we were talking about before about white people being ignorant, I heard repeatedly, almost verbatim, this isn't supposed to be happening to white people. I heard that repeat, and I said, wait a minute, whoa, whoa, whoa. I thought they were ignorant about, right, what do you mean this isn't supposed to be? And they were saying exactly. In the same report, and they were saying blatantly, hey, you know, black people, they expect bad things. And they would say this with a chuckle, like, you know, bad things are always happening to black people. So, you know, when the recession and that sort of, I mean, you know, that's just another day in the life of being a black person. But for white people, like, whoa, like, this is terrible. What is going on? I wanted to get your thoughts on the report and why do you think this is receiving so much attention?
Well, I mean, I'll start with the latter. I think it's receiving attention because there's white people involved, right? But this doesn't really surprise us. I mean, you know, when you look at the numbers, we've constantly seen kind of what's called the gender inversion of lower middle class and even poor whites. You know, they've lost, black white males have lost a lot of ground in terms of education, employment, health, things of that sort. You know, Warren Farrell, I believe his name is. He writes a lot of books on the vulnerabilities of white men. And I think that what happens is the society ultimately implodes because it's not paying attention to the effects that economics, you know, poverty, low health care, funding, you know, disposability. You know, you got to remember, man, like poor white males constitute one of the largest numbers of people that are killed and incarcerated in this country. They also include the largest number of rapists, right? So it's no surprise that these conditions have facilitated death for this group of people. On the other hand, notice how it's interpreted. So the way that we racialize things in this structure, in a white supremacist society, is that we assume that death and poverty belong to the racialized classes. In other words, the reason that people are shocked is like, what do you mean that white people respond to poverty and incarceration the same way that black people do? What do you mean that if people don't have education and health, you know, healthcare access, they end up dying and living shorter lives? You see, these were racialized problems, and they were explained away with racist dogmas, which assumed that black people were of a worser biological stock and were ultimately more dangerous. Now that you see the same effects on white people, this is what's kind of niching away, you know, kind of, you know, chiseling away at some of the ideas of this biological determinism that still holds a lot of weight today in people's minds. You're not going to see it come out in the academy as much, but people still believe that there are biological differences between the races. And that's why this is getting so much attention, because now that we know that white people are dying, now that we know that there's some aspects of oppression and poverty and marginalization that affect white people similarly to other minorities, now they have a problem. Right, and the fact that, and this is what's interesting. This is what's funny about it: the fact that it's affecting poor white men. Right, the same group that's lost tremendous ground in terms of education, tremendous ground in terms of employment. I think that's going to be something that you're going to see disciplines and academics start dealing with. Now, that could work one of two ways. Is less likely to work in a way where people say, this is the consequence of white supremacy and patriarchy, that it even excludes and endangers subordinate white males. But the other part of it, too, now is that it's going to shift discussions away from racism, the little discussion there is, to a focus on classism, because they're going to use the vulnerability of white people to, or this specific group of white people, to now displace the kinds of things that are happening to black people. Because now they can say, this shows that it's classism, not actually white supremacy, that lures the life chances of groups of people, and that should be where the money goes, that's where the grant should go, that's where the intellectual focus should go. right? So I think that it's going to be a very, I don't want to say interesting because I think that word's overused a lot. I think it's going to be a very peculiar position that black intellectuals who study race and racism structures are going to be put in, given these new findings.
Profound point. I definitely I concur. I think that's because, I mean, you already see that momentum of it's about class. It's not about, I felt like there was a lot of emphasis on Zachary Hammond, the little white boy that was shot in South Carolina over the summer.
Yeah, I saw that recently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they were saying, oh, he didn't get attention because he's white. This isn't just a black problem. This happens to white people. And really emphasizing, trying to shift the dialogue. I think even a young white child was shot recently by two non-white enforcement officers in Louisiana. And I exact same thing. It's going to be really easy to kind of get away from that. It's not racism. It's not black. All lives matter.
Let me tell you the problem with that, right? And this is, and I blame black people for this as well. See, what we've done is this. It's infinitely true that when you talk about the rates of killings, right, because black people are such a small number compared to whites in this country, that overwhelmingly the rate of black men killed is astronomical compared to whites, right? So, for example, you know, I showed this to my class last week. So there's been 202, and based on the Washington Post, there have been 202 black men killed, 10 black women killed, okay? When you look at, when you compare that to something like the number of black men, the number of white men killed, right, you're looking at a big difference, right, because there's been 848 people total shot. But what then does that mean? Does that mean that white people are necessarily more vulnerable to police brutality than black people? Not necessarily. It means that poor white people who are in the same kinds of environments that black people are traditionally in because of racism will have the same kinds of consequences. But given that the rate of death amongst black men is so sharp, so again, 202 black men are shot versus something like 387 white men, right? Given that that's so close, given the disparity of how many people are actually involved, it means that there has to be some kind of targeting directed to black males. Now, what we've done in terms of the race issue, like in Black Lives Matter, is we've displaced facts. So we don't like the fact that more white men are killed because we don't want to do any structural analysis or actual analysis to account for why poor white men are being shot and put in jail. And we don't really like the fact that more black men are being shot and put in jail than black women. So now we have to change the narrative. We have to make it about identity politics. And when you make it about identity politics, that's why you can't account for something like these other white people being shot. And it makes it very easy for the other side to say, well, you're concentrating on this identity, but you're excluding this identity. Whereas if we took a structuralist view, then we could say something like, because of poverty and the ways that black male bodies are linked to danger, this is why we see these black men being killed. But when you look structurally, given that cops predominantly shoot racialized males generally and males simply more than women, then this also shows why those white males who they believe, who mainstream society believes, poses similar threats to racialized males are also being killed. That allows us to both capture the dearth of the violence directed against racialized black and brown men and black and brown women, as well as account for how white people are also part of that racialized structure and can be victim to it. It need not shift the focus then to white people, because you can then say these are the environments, stereotypes, and threats that racialized men who they believe are poor, dangerous, etc., have to society. And they're putting that on white people, right? But we don't do that. We don't want actual analysis. We want hashtags. And this is the problem. This is why I say that we're in trouble, because the movements that we conceptualize have started because people put up hashtags on Facebook and not because they were scholars, lawyers, or serious community activists that understood the actual problems that's happening in our society. And that's why you can deflect something like Black Lives Matter, which is a hashtag, to something like All Lives Matter. And even when you see these protests, you know, I mean, I was looking at the protests at Mizzou, you know, and I actually put up a hashtag to ridicule the crime. You know, there was a hashtag movement for Black Powers for Black Men. And I was actually given a shout-out because constantly within Black Lives Matter, you see this argument saying that black men don't do anything politically for black people, especially for black women. And when I saw these, you know, these football players stand up, I was like, look, these are all black men. They did something, et cetera. And sure enough, what did you see? You saw another article the next day where Jonathan Butler saying, oh, it was black queer women, black queer bodies that really started the movement. And I was like, listen, if every movement, if everything that happens amongst black people is going to be about identity, then everything has to now be started by black women or black queer queer bodies, then you're not really doing an analysis of black politics in relation to white supremacy. You're just doing something that says that black queer and female bodies are at the center of every political idea that comes to black people. And that's just woefully inadequate. It's just not true in any case or any era that all ideas comes from one identity of a people. All black men didn't invent everything. All black women didn't invent anything. All black gay people didn't invent anything. But because we're playing the game with pointing to the bodies, this allows us to not be grounded in any actual analysis. We're not using facts. We're just using the people or the faces of the people that we want to be at the front of the movement. And I think that's very dangerous because when you look at something like All Lives Matter, it allows them to play this very same game. Right, it's not a rigorous account, and we could easily answer this. We just need people that do a little bit more reading and less time, spending less time on blogs and MSNBC, trying to actually talk about the problems that exist within black communities, be that economics, police brutality, or the very real poverty that we have that's causing a lot of these other deviant behaviors like robbery, drugs, and domestic abuse.
Wow. Dr. Tommy Curry, I want to nab some of the folks who dialed in with a question.
I do emphasize
pretty regularly, if we are in a system of racism, white supremacy, white people are most to blame for everything.
But they create the structures, absolutely.
Right on, right on. The person that called in, 5640, did you have a question for Dr. Curry? You should be with us.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Gus and Dr. Curry.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. I understand, according to the attorney at war, Alton Maddox, he, based on his experience and through his study, the reason why black women are, or there's no consequence for the rapes of black women is because black women are still considered the property of white men. Would you be able to elaborate on that? I know you're not, I don't know if you have a Juris Doctorate, but I just wanted to get your feedback on that.
No, I appreciate that. A lot of my work is in jurisprudence, but I'm familiar with that argument. In fact, there was a study published in 2011 that said that a white man in this country has never been given the death penalty for the rape of a black woman. So I think there is some truth to that. I think there is some truth to the idea that white men's sexual violence against black women is very much still related to, or if not determined by, the master-slave relationship that we had, you know, in the early to mid 1800s. That being said, I think that when we look then at the consequences of gender, that gender, or what we call gender or sex, has when it pertains to females, that we need a much richer racial analysis, right? That really looks at that, that centers that aspect of the relationship between white males and black females, instead of what we do today, which is just assume that black women are vulnerable to all males, regardless of class status, et cetera, because that's not the same thing that's happening. We've kind of lost the racial aspect of how rape happens, and specifically how the criminal justice system looks at and evaluates rape. As you know, you have to think about this. If white cops are getting away with shooting black males on video camera, is it going to be hard for them to get away with raping black women where the only thing or only evidence we have are their words, right? This is what I mean. We're not paying attention to the kinds of structural impediments that we have to justice. We're just claiming that brutality is evidence enough, and in a white supremacist society, that's just not the case. Minorities are being brutalized. Like I said, you know, black people are being deported. Like, black citizens from Houston were being sent to Mexico simply because they look like they don't belong here. I mean, these are very real issues that are based in systems, not just individual perceptions, but systems of black people not being wanted. So I think his theory has potential. I think that there is a case to be made that property relations between white men and black women from slavery forward certainly could be at the bottom of that.
Thank you very much.
No, thank you, ma'am.
Right on. Thomas in New York, we will get your thoughts on the Gospel of Mac before the broadcast ends, before we wrap up today. I'll make sure you get your time. But did you have a question for Dr. Curry? You should be with us. Thomas in New York.
Yes, sir. Good evening, Dr. Curry.
Good evening, sir.
I'm glad to speak to you. I had a question. I was watching the news today, and they showed another black snuff film of this black man handcuffed, kicked out a cop car window. He was being brought to the hospital.
Yeah.
And he was tased to death. And you see the cops opening the car door and just tasing him as he's shackled and handcuffed in the back of the cop car. And I just want to know, what was your thoughts on that?
Well, look, you know, one of the things that infuriates me the most when we look at the deaths of black males is that there seems to be a fetish, right? It's like you say, it's like a snuff film, right? There's a market for people looking at and viewing the death of black male bodies. You know, it's one of the things that I've, you know, said at conferences, that when you look at how black male death is displayed compared to even black female death, and certainly white death, there's more respect with white death. There's an idea that you don't need to see dead white bodies. And even with black female death, you don't see these dead bodies paraded in front of you the same way that you do with black males. Every time a black male in this country dies, so you think of Mike Brown and the photographs of his dead body bleeding out on the sidewalk. You think about Trayvon Martin, where you saw post after post of his dead body on the street. You think about Sam DuBose, where we've seen the video of him being shot in the head, and even, you know, the cop looking at him, his blood is spilling out over his shirt, bleeding from his head. You look at Oscar Grant, the video of him on YouTube being shot and killed in front of us, right? You see, time and time again, we're constantly shown black men being killed. Like, we don't see that for other bodies. So my reaction to that is, this is yet another example of the kind of fetishization that we have for black male death. Tamir Rice, we saw a 12-year-old black boy get gunned down, and there's no reaction. We accept these things as normal, and this is not just white people doing this, but we've become almost immune to it as black people as well, that the death of black men don't shock us. It doesn't shock us. We see, if we saw a black woman's body dangling from a tree, that would shock us. But we've seen black boys, black men being, you know, mutilated, distorted, lynched, like the boy that was in North Carolina. That was, you know, these types of images feed some kind of necessity for the American public. And instead of us trying to insist that these black male bodies deserve respect and that they deserve the same kind of observance that we give to other bodies, that's not what's done. So it suggests to me that there's something about being black and male in this country. There's something about being a racialized, subordinate male in this country that allows people to enjoy your death, to enjoy viewing the death, and to enjoy the process of killing these kinds of bodies. And I think this is just the most recent example.
Well, very well said. My last thing for you, I just wanted to know your thoughts on this, because I wrote Gus and I said, after the Missouri thing happened, I said, man, I would hate to be a black person on that campus, man. And today we see all these death threats. A lot of blacks stayed home from school today because of threats that were posted. And what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I think the problem is that we're not socializing black people to understand what they're actually battling against. I think those movements are commendable. I think that it's a signal that something should be done. But the problem is that the generation believes that when they do something, that's the end of the battle. You see, we don't understand white backlash as a function of black progress. We think we do something, we expect recognition for what we've done, but we assume no bad consequences follow from impending or trying to challenge white supremacy. And if we understood that we were trying to challenge white supremacy, that we are literally in battle with a force that seeks to dominate groups of black people, right? We understand that we're dealing with institutions that do not expect black people to actually comprise the majority of them, like predominantly white universities. The reason they're PWIs is because institutionally they're fixated on making sure that blacks are the minority within them. So if blacks are the minority within an institutional structure and they're minority in the society that houses the institution, and the society is racist, why do we then not expect the institution itself to be racist? The institution reflects the will and the needs of the society. It's not going to contradict the society, because the society is what feeds and nurtures the institutions, like universities. Right, so what you have then are people who've expended energy for a certain effect, right? The resignation of Tom Wolf, but have not thought about the way that the white public is going to impose its will upon them for doing so. And this is what I mean when I say that the way that we think about racism now is so short-sighted. It presupposes a kind of reality that assumes that recognition and contact and discourse and discussion is the ultimate, you know, mediator of what's going to come. In other words, if we talk about it, if we show that we've done something right, then white people's whole consciousness is going to change. That is not how racism functions. Racism bursts itself over and over again. Every part of an action that black people get causes a reaction by white people. This is part of Derrick Bell's interest conversion. This is the cyclical nature of racism. We see the same thing in Du Bois. We see the same thing in Fanon. We see the same thing in the, you know, in the Black Panthers. We know that systems respond to attacks. And if we don't prepare ourselves, if we don't prepare these students for these kinds of attacks, then ultimately what we're doing is only having short-sighted and piecemeal kinds of blow-ups that are designed for one specific action in a locale and not insisting on restructuring the rest of the country, not insisting on restructuring the fundamental order of relations that sustain racism, which would be economics, universities, employment, healthcare, poverty. You know, these are the systemic issues that sustain racism, not just, you know, the one thing that happened in Mizzou. And I think that's what we're missing. That's why the whites are reacting, because they're fighting to get the status quo back in equilibrium.
That is.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you very much, Gus. I'll meet my wife.
Right on. Good to hear from you, sir. The person that called in, 9769. 9769. Did you have a question for Dr. Curry?
Hi, greetings, Gus and Dr. Curry.
Greetings.
Dr. Curry, what are your thoughts on white people who are concerned about their free speech? It seems to me that white people feel that when black people speak up or act against racism, white supremacy, that they feel that it's going to infringe on their right to free speech. Can you explain that phenomena?
Well, I think the idea of free speech, I think they're largely talking about the political correctness aspect of it, right? And I think that in a country like the United States, where free speech is absolutely integral to how black people conceptualize their political power and utility, that, you know, that's something that black people and the country have to bite the bullet on. In other words, amongst academic classes and, like, really liberal classes of black people, right? So if you think about your Ebony's, if you think about what you see on MSNBC, those types of things, then you're going to see an insistence on political correctness, right? The idea that you shouldn't say X about black people. But when you look at what's happening on the ground, when you look at how black communities are dealing with these things, they're having a completely different conversation, because they're talking about black people dying, militarization, etc. White people are reacting to that in two ways. The first is they see, well, if I can't say what I want to say about black people, or if I disagree with this kind of liberal ideology, do I have the space to say it? The answer to that, of course, is yes. It may not be stuff we want to hear, but that's just kind of the double burden of free speech. The second part is more insidious. The second aspect of what they're suggesting is that people don't have the right to say it, right? Because it's hate speech, or it's inflammatory, or it's tries to silence or target groups of white people. Now, that aspect of it, right, whereas that black people doing these actions, attacking white supremacy, attacking white violence, that actually harms white people, that's a retreat in them saying that we have to protect our rights of association over and against black people's, and that's the most dangerous one. White people have always complained that whenever black people say something, that it infringes on some rights they have. But that's because white people define their rights not on the basis of, you know, them people not infringing on them, but rather what they can impose on other people. They think of everything as positive rights, what they could actually do with them. Black people, on the other hand, think of it, are, you know, most oppressed groups think of it negatively. In other words, what these rights prevent others from doing to us, right? And I think that that's a very important distinction, because what we see is that the dominant group with power sees that any kind of protest, any kind of demand by the oppressed group, in fact, trades off of what they take to be their ultimate liberty. And this, to me, again, just shows the evidence that privilege is not something whites somehow don't know about. Because if they didn't know about privilege, then they would be unaware of the consequences that black political action or protest had on them. But they're very aware because they backlash against it like for the last 100 years. So it suggests that white people are not only aware of it, but see it as dangerous, right? And I think that this is something, these are kind of renewed conversations about racism that we have to have in the 21st century. We've worked on the view that everyone's here just to learn and listen when it's very clear that white people are afraid of black progress precisely because it infringes not only their free speech rights, but their rights of association, rights on property. And ultimately, you know, it's like we see with the Voting Rights Act. You know, they want to make sure that black people and other racial minorities know that this is not their country. I mean, that's the platform that somebody like Trump is working from. Right, so it's that fear and anxiety that whites have of blacks that allows them to in many ways substantiate this.
Okay, I just have one more question. Earlier, you mentioned how poor whites or working class whites are going to take the conversation towards classism, and I think I see that happening in the UK, where the discussion is on how working class whites, poor whites, are falling behind in education, falling behind Pakistanis, West Indian blacks, et cetera, et cetera. Do you foresee that happening here in America, United States?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And the reason, you see, this is the problem.
Oh, sorry. It's all my fault.
This is the problem. The problem is that when you're talking about entities that decide policy, they're not going to be guided by the discussions that are occurring on blogs. The discussion that occur on blogs is about centering certain bodies. Amongst black people, it's centering black female, black queer, or queer bodies. Amongst white people, it's centering white female bodies. The problem is that since black people don't have any power, they have to argue amongst themselves to try to get and argue for vulnerability. So we don't have money and power, so we try to, it's a race to the bottom, so to speak. Who's the most oppressed so that one group gets recognized by white people? Amongst white people, however, the case is a little different. Since you're now having a population of white males who are falling behind white women as well as other racialized minorities, the question becomes, what then does the white race decide to do to bring those groups of young men back into the fold? Now, you may have some resistance from liberal whites about this, you know, advancing patriarchy, etc. But ultimately, as history suggested, when it comes to an issue of whether or not the white race has enough white men, they focus specifically on having white women have more white men. And I think that this is going to be the change of discussion that we're going to see in the next 10 to 15 years. Because now that we know that poor white men are dying, young white boys are falling behind every other group, and mind you, this is happening in the United States as well, and there's going to be a renewed sense of nationalism, I believe, that's going to come about, that's going to start validating the experiences of white males. And I think that this, again, is some of the stuff that, you know, that's been talked about in the last decade or so about the boy crisis in America. And they've tried to make that a global problem where it's like, well, white boys are in trouble. It's true statistically that white boys are in trouble. But the real issue is that when you look at other groups, brown and black boys have always been in trouble. The system's been structured that way since the turn of the century. I mean, this is what Du Bois talks about in The Spawn of Slavery. In the rise of the convict lease system, this is what's talked about in the 1950s, given that black men have always been the smaller number of people in college. This is what was talked about in the 1980s when institutional decimation, where black men who were undereducated, unemployed, were actually decimated by the incarceration system because they could no longer find work. I mean, this is the pattern that's been playing out. I don't think white supremacy is going to simply let white men fall out of the fold. And I think that the discussions and the academic culture and even the policy culture is going to reflect that in the coming years.
Okay. Thank you for answering my questions, Dr. Curry.
No, I appreciate it, sir. Thank you.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Other folks, don't dally if you want to get a question in for Dr. Curry. Just building on the last caller, it reminded me, we just had Dr. Welzig on the program a couple days ago, and she was relating present-day United States to the Third Reich, Nazi Germany. And what you were just saying, I was thinking, nothing rallies and rejuvenates white masculinity like dead black bodies.
No, this is true.
I was thinking Delectable Negro, but yeah, did you want to respond?
Yeah, Witter's book?
Yes, sir.
It's a great book. You know, the last few chapters, but the first three or four chapters are outstanding. I think, you know, we talked about this before. I think that in a patriarchal society, one of the things that feminist discourse misses is that patriarchy requires the extinguishing of subordinate males, right? When you see all white society, so if you look at Europe as a case study, you find the subordinate males of the lower classes were constantly looked at as disposable next to the males higher up in the aristocracy. You take that same model and you import it out to the colonies, you see the same notion of these poor white men who are disposable colonizing the rest of the world under the command of rich white men. And those men internalize the same kind of hierarchical modality where subjugated, racialized native males now become disposable males next to them. This is an aspect of how we look at patriarchal and white supremacist societies in our modern day that never gets talked about. Now, once we start understanding that, then we understand then that the death of these subordinate racial males is actually a rite of passage in a certain sense. It's a way for them not only to decrease the biological pool for reproduction, so it decreases reproductive competition, but it also situates them in a position of power as the alpha male, so to speak, right? So if you think back to Herbert Spencer's notion of social Darwinism, or if you even think about some of the ethnological findings of the 19th century, part of the white man's burden was making sure that savage males were kept low enough that they wouldn't repopulate, right? That they wouldn't be able to repopulate the savage races. I think you can look into the 20th century, certainly the first half of the 20th century, and still see this kind of understanding emerging, like in the 1920s and 30s. So we think, and remember, this is only 60, 70 years ago. So we think we're that far removed from the kind of ideals where we see black men and brown men comprising large portions of the prison industrial complex, large portions of police homicides, as well as homicides amongst themselves, then I don't think that we're getting a very accurate picture of how racism does, in fact, function, right? So I think you're right. I think that the killing and murdering of racialized men is something that, in many ways, rejuvenates and justifies militarism as well as white masculinity.
I was, as I said, Dr. Welsing, she was just with us. And a caller asked her about kind of this, as exactly what you just touched on, this normalization of black death, even the fetishization of black death. And she, Dr. Welsing, she was saying that she, on CNN, her observation over the past couple weeks, they've been having a lot of segments on Jim Jones in Guyana, South America, Jonestown, hundreds of dead black bodies. And she said she just kept seeing this footage, and she said there was really no context. Like, was this some sort of, like, why are you showing this now? Like, something that happened all those years ago. And she said that she felt like it was just normalizing just huge, large amounts of black death just to make this, hey, whatever.
Oh, absolutely.
And I wanted to get just your thoughts, because you touched on it earlier. I think Isabel Wilkerson, she did a really important piece just a few months back where she was comparing all of these, the dash cam footage, the cell phone footage, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, all of these incidents to lynching photographs from the early 20th century, and saying that, you know, these videos, they're on YouTube and everywhere else, you can get way more views than a postcard from the early 20th century. Like, what are your thoughts?
No, I think that's true. I think that's true. You know, it's, again, you know, what's the most difficult thing, guys, is that when you see people do actually good scholarship, and it gets sucked up because people pay more attention to blogs, right? You know, and that's the problem. I mean, I think that argument is completely correct, and I think that you can actually trace the relationships to that, not only by the views, but just the way that they're circulated, right? I mean, what other bodies are circulated in that way? And I think that one of the things that happens, and this is the most unfortunate part about it, is that because of how identity politics functions, we're doing the circulation for them. And this is what I mean by that, is that we have normalized the deaths of black and brown men in this country, and even African men and boys, right? So remember Boko Haram, when they kidnapped the 200 girls, right? The month before that, or before the kidnapping, they killed 60 boys. right? You had African women telling the West that you're focusing on the wrong thing because they're coming in and taking the girls because they're murdering the husbands and the sons to take them. So even when African women were saying that this is a function of how the West is trying to interpret our views of the actual deaths in our society, the West said that these men and boys were irrelevant. You do the same thing in the United States where you keep you see so many black and brown men and boys dying, and then we have the photographs. They're passed around like lynching photos, but we're not talking about that aspect because we say that we need to focus on other bodies, female bodies, queer bodies, and trans bodies, right? And if you add all those deaths together, they don't. If you add black, queer, black female, and black trans bodies killed by police to the number of black men killed by police, black men still outnumber by over 100. So then we have to ask ourselves the question, why are we focused on identity and not the systemic ills that create the conditions by which black people as a whole are murdered? Why are we playing this game like we can already assign value to the deaths? Why are we the ones that are somehow saying what a black life means and that this black life is born with the wrong genitalia, that it has less worth than other life? Why are we not talking about the conditions that breed police brutality as if we're not all vulnerable to it? Right, and I always point to the case of Ayanna Stanley. We talk about her because she's a black girl that got shot, but we're not talking about the fact that it's the conditions of the no-knock raid to come get the father that allowed that baby that created the conditions for that baby to be shot. Now, we don't understand that in terms of the relationship that it has to blackness, to black homes and black families, to black men and women and boys and girls, then we're losing the point. And saying this will be unpopular so because it's not what blogs are saying. But when we do actual research, and this is why I say we need scholars that are held accountable by the black public, then what we have to actually, in fact, do is make sure that our accounts of racism are telling the truth and not trying to serve as a mouthpiece for the advancement of people who have absolutely no connection or interest in black communities that are being killed and dying.
Context of white supremacy. Our retired firefighter in Florida, did you have a question for Dr. Curry? You should be with us.
Yes, sir. Greetings, everyone. Being that I'm a present-day high school football coach, Mr. Curry, could you give us your understandings of the possibility of the incident taking place in Missouri with the scholarship football player at the University of Missouri, how it can be transferable to more assistance towards working towards the ending of racism, white supremacy by individuals who happen to be athletes. Could you give us your ideas on how that can possibly be transferable and spread even more than what it already has? I can recall the first time I've heard about something like that was in 1965 with the AFL All-Star Game, where football players actually rebelled against the system of racism white supremacy. But this is a recent thing now, and I'm hoping that it spreads. And give us your thoughts on that.
No, sir, I think that this is a model that we should emulate for a few reasons. First, you know, I have a colleague here, Jonathan Singer, extraordinary professor, extraordinary friend, and one of the things that he does, he works on black male college athletes, and he told me an interesting fact one day. He suggested to me that one of the reasons that you can have so many different sports at universities, specifically the sports that take care of, you know, Title IX, the sports for women, is that you use the money that football and basketball teams raise. Now, if we think about that seriously, most competitive college programs in football and basketball utilize and exploit the labor of black males. So one of the keys that I think Mizzou shows us is that black male labor in universities are in fact responsible for the ways that universities actually fund and take care of the white people. So what we need then, and this is where I think scholars and the black public can make sure that the scholarship is useful. If we have people working on, this means lawyers too, working on how to organize, how to systematically organize student athlete strikes, right? Specifically amongst football and basketball teams. Because we know football teams bring in the most money for most major colleges. Those are predominantly, they can only be male. And we know that basketball teams have black females and males, right? Those are the major
right.
sources of revenue. So if we can get people to start saying, well, listen, here's your rights as a student. If you decide to do this, here's how you go about it. Here's how they're fined. Here's how this affects other sports. Here's how, you know, if we understood the full gravity of what's going on and had people with law degrees and people who were supporters and understood the sociology of it, et cetera, then we could actually organize nationwide protests that are not about, it's not about us just having a voice, but it's about how can you hurt universities economically. Right. And see, that's what, mm-hmm. you know, C. Thomas Fortune said that the problem with the Caucasian is they never think about above profit and their own self-interest. And this is what Derrick Bell was saying, that you won't make white people change because of their compassion for black people, but you can make white people do what you want if you hurt their pockets. And this is an example of us being able to hurt their pockets. The problem is they've been interpreting this as part of this Black Lives Matter stuff, and they haven't looked at the fact that this is an independent economic boycott that these players stumbled over because it would cost their school $1 million if they didn't play per game, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This
mm-hmm.
is something, you see, but this is what I mean. This is about us understanding the structures we operate in. This isn't about us sharing hashtags. This is about us organizing black male professional athletes in the case of football and black male, black student athletes generally in terms of how they can make a whole university accountable to the climates of racism that they have at their campuses. And that's how that spreads. It takes us actually having conversations and organizing with student athletes. But again, you look at, it's been 3 or 4 days, not one article's come out about that. We're arguing about who started it. We're arguing about the identities and sexual orientations of the people that went on strike. We're arguing about whether or not black, you know, we argue about silly things, right? Because people want attention and recognition. We're not arguing about, well, what's going to be, how do we protect these children and students from white backlashes, and how do we use this as a model that can be used, can be utilized across the country for people, for black people and brown people who are specifically unhappy with the conditions and climate of their university.
Uh-huh. That leads me to my next question and last question. What possible backlash that the NCAA would take out on these black males and also possible incidents in the future?
I think, of course, the biggest thing for any kind of student athlete is whether or not they're going to be able to keep their scholarship,
mm-hmm.
their status
mm-hmm.
at the university. So I think that's why we need lawyers that are able to give their professional opinions and protection to these types of events. If we just walk out there because we're trying to be radical, if we're missing the boat. The real issue is how do we create organized protests that we have cases about, that we have people that can, in fact, advocate on the case of, that are necessary for these students, that create avenues and instruments that these students can utilize in protesting. You see, this is what I mean. Like, organization has to be a group thing, right? If we just leave students out there like that's what students are doing, if we just bring in people who are activists that want to stay in the spotlight, like some of the people in Black Lives Matter, this ultimately does not do anything for the community. It helps those individuals, but it doesn't help the community. This is about a community, a sustained community effort where people can protect students and the community can be educated in terms of how their activity and support of these students could, in fact, be useful. For example, if they say that a student can no longer go to school there, right, then it would be useful mm-hmm. if people or families in that community could do something to help that student, whether it be food,
right.
clothing, board, things of that sort. If we knew that lawyers were there, lawyers could take that case, right? See, that's
right.
what I mean.
Right.
People prepared, people ready to say, if the university responds in this way, we have people that can work on this, right? These are
right.
the types of things that we need. Other people, other professors will say, well, we know that this student can't go there, they'll go here now, right? These are the types of networks and communities that black people need. This is about organization. This is not about what I think we've reduced this 21st century civil rights movement to, which are appeals to white consciousness.
Right, right. I understand where you're coming from. I was involved in a similar situation many years ago where the community in the Oklahoma City area really came to the aid of students who were trying to keep Langston University open in the mid-70s. So it sounds like you're pretty accurate on your analysis. Thank you, sir.
I appreciate it, sir. No, thank you for the question.
Yes, sir.
The caller at 5234, did you have a question?
Yes. Hello, good evening to Dr. Curry and to you, Gus, and all of the callers. Yes, I had two questions. One was in reference to the situation in Missouri. The reason why is because I spoke to a coworker about this, basically a similar situation that you, or similar to what you just discussed, was that we don't see the or understand that to strike at this organization, boycotting, or that the system, excuse me, boycotting is probably the best tool that we have, nonviolently speaking, to cripple the system and to get some results. And I think these young people were a stellar example of what black people coming together collectively and taking the stand could do. And I wanted to know, what would be your suggestions as far as trying to get more of our people to understand the system of racism, white supremacy, and the way in which we can organize around something like that? Because when you boycott, you don't necessarily have to agree with everyone or get along with them, but if you have an understanding of what your problem is and you all agree on that, then you can make moves collectively to get something done about it. And I was just asking, what would you say would be some of the best means of reaching our people to get them to understand the entire system, the global system of racism, white supremacy, and working together collectively to cripple that and destroy it?
Well, that's a great question. I think that we're working from the bottom up. Structural interpretations and analysis of racism are no longer popular under the kind of pop intersectional era now. Everything's about identity. I can tell you personally that anytime I bring up these types of issues, that they're largely met with hostility, despite the numbers and facts that I bring them with. So I just don't think that this is necessarily the culture of young people or the culture of academics or activists that really understand the complexities of racism and white supremacy. Everything now is about or sexual orientation, gender identity, inclusion, exclusion frames. So how do you go against that? Well, I think there are a few ways. I really enjoyed a piece that Atlanta Black Star ran a few months ago about white privilege. I think that it was very important. I think that we have to utilize black journalistic avenues. I think that we need to make sure that professors and thinkers that we think are important are kind of highlighted to the public. So I think that means that it requires a much bigger black journalistic force that we see now. And I think we need people that actually confront and offer counter stories to the ways that black politics and civil rights are being conducted right now. One of the big things you had in the 1950s, 60s, and even the 70s were very real debates amongst the black public of whether or not ideas worked. Today we have the exact opposite of that. The reign of black Twitter, the reign of black social media is that if you do not conform, then you're to be condemned. And that only breeds ideological loyalty. It doesn't breed critical thinking or even an active political public culture. One of the problems with the public intellectuals that we have today is that they're not very intellectual. They all say the same thing. They're all friends with each other. There's no antagonism or disagreement between different ideas that it could possibly lead to the liberation of black people or substantially improve the actual conditions of black people. And with that being the case, you can't have different views that the black public gets so that they can generate new ideas. So I think that, you know, we're in a very bad position because critical thinking is not something that either the public intellectuals or the public are given. Rather, we're actually trying to get everybody to be part of a choir and all say the words of intersectionality and nonviolence and Black Lives Matter. In many ways, this is an avant-garde position that wants to destroy any people who dissent to it. Is not interested in trying to cultivate multiple conversations or multiple forums for debates about the situation. So I think that it's going to be very, very difficult at this point.
All right. Thank you very much for that answer. And my other question was something I brought up with Dr. Francis Cress-Welsing in regards to Daniel Holzclaw.
Yes.
When I took a look at his situation and his story, I thought about Jeffrey Dahmer. And Jeffrey Dahmer, in a previous episode of the Child's Gus interviewed someone who discussed with Jeffrey Dahmer the fact that he had a predatory nature with which he was able to have kind of a foresight as to which black people he would be able to take advantage of and eventually kill and eat. And I compared that to Daniel Holzclaw choosing streetwalkers and drug-addicted black females to rape and sexually assault serially. And the woman, Mrs. Franklin, that Gus interviewed in reference to the Daniel Holzclaw situation, she said the only thing that he didn't do was start to kill black females. She said she believed that was the next step, and I believe the same thing. I wanted to know how would you compare linked him to Jeffrey Dahmer. The only thing is he didn't get the opportunity to actually kill the black body or potentially eat the black body.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, I think Gus's use of delectable Negro was very appropriate in this sense. Look, you know, violence against black people breeds more violence against black people, right? So I think ultimately that's what you're dealing with. And I think that, you know, with Jeffrey Dahmer is really interesting because Dahmer was a white man who was homosexual that would end up killing his male lovers. And many of his lovers, like this, the one person that he killed right before he was actually arrested, was a Vietnamese man. So a young Vietnamese teenage boy. So I think given that, we can see the ways in which the sexual eroticism and the desire for dead black bodies lends itself to that kind of violence. So yeah, I can see an argument for why the kind of rape of black women could ultimately lead to the consumption and murdering of black people more generally.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. You're one of my favorite callers. I mean, guests on the show. And
appreciate
keep
that,
doing
sir.
What
Thank
you're doing.
You.
Please keep doing what you're doing. We need brothers like you out there. Thanks again, Gus.
Thank you.
The caller at 6353. Did you have a question for Dr. Curry?
I have a couple of questions, but I wanted to make this comment about what you said, Dr. Curry, regarding what do we do. In other words, this incident at the university where our children actually took a stand,
mm-hmm.
and what we did. Now, we, as adults, like you said, we don't have the proper analysis to go with, okay, the next step in protecting our children is what? So when we saw, I guess I got this term from Gus, the Voltron effect take place, where you have all of the white supremacists step out forward and all of the negative comments about our children, and now you know the heat is coming.
Mm-hmm.
So that backlash. So I wanted to commend you on that analysis. I think that's critically
ma'am.
Important. But when you say that, here's my two questions. You keep saying, for number one, what do you think our collective response should be to, you know, this sadistic, racist, white supremacist response to the death of black male bodies? It's almost as if you're saying this identity analysis that you're making,
mm-hmm.
you almost seem to me to be saying that black women are allied with in our desensitivity about seeing it so much,
mm-hmm.
that we're almost an ally to that identity analysis regarding the death of black males by we're desensitized. What are you saying?
So I'm saying that, I'm sorry, go ahead, I didn't interrupt you, I thought.
If you got my question, you can go right ahead.
Yes, ma'am. No, I'm saying that even black people as a whole are desensitized to the death of black males, right? And that there are certain academic classes of feminism and black feminism which suggest that we don't talk about black male death that furthers that erasure. So that's not to say that black women generally participate. It's to say that black people, because we live in a white supremacist society, don't always focus on the kinds of disparities that we see amongst black people generally, and even black men specifically. Because, you know, it's just like I said, we see black men dying and going to jail every day. Now, that doesn't mean that we're the ones doing it. It's not meaning that we're encouraging it. But I'm saying that this is just one of the products of what happens when you live in a white supremacist society. The other part I was talking about when I'm talking about black women is not saying all black women. I'm saying that educated feminists, that's black women and black men, because they want to focus on different bodies, also participate in that. That's a class issue, not just a racial issue. Does that clarify?
That's profound. So that's prevalent, because I see it. Okay, let me filter through that. I get your point. I'm going to observe from now on how serious this problem is.
Right.
But thank you for your response.
No, ma'am. No, ma'am. I think it was a very important question. And let me just add this. One of the things that we forget, right, and this is something that you see within all our great thinkers, from Du Bois to Fanon to even Angela Davis. She makes this point as well. And Elaine Brown does, especially in her book, The Condemnation of Little B. We have classes of black people that internalize negative views about other black people, right? You know, we all have that cousin or that relative or person who's kind of made it and thinks everybody else who didn't, right, is pathological, right?
Sure, yes.
So those, now imagine all those people within that class that believe the same thing. So those are the people, right, who are educated black men that think that these black men are just lazy and dangerous. It's with black women in the academy, you just have a name for it, right? So there's certain branches of feminism and certain branches of black feminism, not all, but some, right, that say that, well, we've focused on black men enough, let's now focus to other bodies, black queer choir bodies, black women, et cetera, right? So I say, what then does that effect have when these educated middle-class black people hold negative views about poor working-class black people? Because those are the people, those are the men and women who are getting killed, right? That's what we have to start to, we have to talk about these class distinctions and how we internalize certain aspects and ideas of white supremacy as well. We can't keep externalizing it.
Yes, sir. I'm going to close with this last comment. You're absolutely right. I almost forgot about that aspect. I'm so focused on the day-to-day fight that's going on and moment-to-moment. But you're absolutely right. I'm going to filter through that a little bit more and observe it some more, but I think you're right.
No, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Other folks, if you all have a question you want to get in, do not dally and wait till the last minute if you want to get Dr. Curry's response on something. Just going back to the Missouri situation really quick, there was recently a documentary on Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and talking about how racism impacted his sports career, and particularly because he was much like the predecessor to the black athletes football team, players, speaking out and not participating in the Olympics back in the 1960s, and they even had some of the footage and content. I mean, you talk about backlash, like, man, like, to this day, I would even insist, like, he is not given the same, you know, credit and that sort of thing, not received the same way as other people. But I wanted to talk just in terms of backlash. Dave Zirin, he was on Democracy Now! Today talking about all this. And one thing that he didn't mention that I thought was really important, I think it was last year, Marcus Smart, who's now in the NBA, but at the time he was at Oklahoma State University, and he was at a game, he was playing Texas Tech, and this white guy, he says, was calling him racial slurs, and he shoved him, and it was a big to-do about all this, and they talked about racism in college sports. And Dave Zirin said that there is a code in place at these big time schools where they tell black athletes, this is going to happen. It's likely that there's going to be a white person at the game who might yell and call you a nigger or whatever the case may be. Don't talk about it. Like, they will tell them, this happens, you don't go to the press, you don't talk about it, you're not supposed to bring this up. And they've already codified how to deal with that, because apparently they know that this is pretty common, which is not surprising. It's my opinion, I would think you would see the same level of codification moving forward. Like, we're not going to have these periodic revolts on the plantation. We are going to codify this so that they know up front that there will be major consequences if, you know, you get any ideas that you think you want to, you know, not play a game. Your thoughts?
No, I think you're right. I mean, look good. You know, one of the things about white supremacy, and, you know, this is something that I have to say, about how scholars look at it. White people are not stupid, right? They have engineered a society that is meant to keep going. And what happens is that in every generation, so you think of the work of Gerald Horn, you think of even the work of W.E.B. Du Bois, people never listen to these people during their lifetime, right? No matter how much work they produce, no matter how truthful what they say is, they never listen to them while they're alive. So that means that instead of us being, and notice the difference between black people's analysis of racism and white people's analysis of civilization. White people and white scholars are applauded and celebrated during their lifetimes for their achievements, because their achievements are thought to be something that the society could emulate. there's something there. They take positions, in other words, that carves out niches of fields that other people want to be just like them. But when you talk about black people, especially the pessimism of black men, so think here about someone like Frantz Fanon or someone like Derrick Bell, who passed in 2011. People will look at those figures and say they're interesting and they have an interesting perspective, but ultimately condemn them as ultimately wrong because they're pessimistic about the realities that confront black people in this society. So when you look at these students and you say, if someone says the society will adjust, they will pass laws, they will pass policies so that this does not become a mainstay of the college cultural environment or even a mechanism by which college athletes are going to be able to disrupt these huge financially profitable endeavors like college football. People then say, well, that's not right. But because we have no power, the NCAA will pass a policy, we'll complain about it for about 6 months to a year, and then it will become law and nobody will think about it again. So what we see is this constant encroachment of, or rather I should say diminishing, of black intellectual capacity. Because everything that we can analyze and then use as a model becomes interrupted and stopped before we can actually put it into practice. And those people who are going to keep writing about it, who are going to keep insisting that what we're seeing is not an anomaly, but actually the structural manifestations of how white supremacy actually functions, that far surpasses something like your identity, those people will not be in vogue during this time period. You will have people that continue to assert that Black Lives Matter. You will have local protests. After the election is over, you will see people get concessions, and then the movement, because it is no longer profitable, will die down. We've already seen the co-optation by the Democratic Party of Black Lives Matter. We've already seen the elevation of certain members of Black Lives Matter in speaking series and at major universities. We've already seen people get independent speaker contracts, right? This is the way that these groups profit and the movements become diffuse. Now, what we actually need is people who are going to say, like I said, this is why lawyers are important, political scientists are important. We need people to understand that if this is coming, how do we try to stop it? We need people to say, okay, if this is coming, what are the ways can we attack universities? We need people actively thinking about that. We need dissertations and scholars thinking about that. We need lawyers talking to these new scholars thinking about that, right? But because we're always focused on identity in the now, we're not going to capture this moment. We're not going to capture the glimpse of brilliance that these students randomly created. And inevitably, this will become another blog show with very little empirical work, very little research, and very little of anything to do with how the overall movement goes on. You see, when you think about people like Belafonte, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, you're looking at people who were socialized within a time period to believe that every black person who was representative of black people had a duty to black people. Now, that is the place of the activist. Now, that is the place of the person that is part of Black Lives Matter. Now, that's the place of the person who wants to be the public intellectual. Our black scholars are failing at the job to bring knowledge to the people. And I don't mean through writing on Huffington Post, because that's the avenue that white people read. And other middle-class black people, that's what they aspire to. I mean, they're not black people engaging black journalists and journalism so that those people, black people, get to have a direct line to black professors, scholars, and activists on the issues that affect black people. And that's the failure, right? I mean, that's the failure. I mean, we have Black Agenda Report, we have Atlanta Black Star. These are avenues that should be publishing black scholars and black professors. These are avenues that should be, you know how Ebony was back in the 1960s and 70s?
Absolutely.
Right? That's what I mean, you know, because I was going through that for my research because I'm finishing my book. I got 5,000 words left, right? And I was amazed by how many black PhDs and sociologists and historians were writing articles for Ebony. And I thought about that for a moment. See, now when you read Ebony, you get this very, you know, very shoddy scholarship about, you know, identity politics, black male privilege, etc. But there was a point in time where black journals legitimately housed black scholarship. It's where black debates happened about what was the best alternative or what it, you know, I was reading the piece not a few days ago that appeared in Ebony about the shortage of black women. Black people would publish their results in academic journals and then go write their results up for the black public in these other venues. And today, there's no direct inlet that we have that allows black scholars to publish their work academically and then write articles about the very same work they publish for black communities and black public to consume. Not one avenue. So then you ask how we sustain movements, but we don't even have the very information about the society that black professors are studying that can inform the public. Because the people who control the movement aren't reading these black journalistic journalistic venues. They're reading blogs. And those blogs all have one thing in common. They're all aimed at middle-class and upper-middle-class black people's aspirations and interpretation of racism and not the concrete realities that all the social sciences, all the economists, all the historians are showing has existed beyond since for the last 100 years. And that's our failure, Gus. That's our failure because we have not organized to allow an inlet of the public to engage with ideas that they can use to creatively create with. Right? Mizzou happens spontaneously. Right? But there are other ways in which black scholars and black activists can get to the public besides having to go through Melissa Harris Perry. Now, that's no hate on her, but that's one small narrative, right? That's one perspective. That's not all perspectives. And what we've done is we've created people that now only have one outlet, one view, one vision, and one perspective. That is not how you generate social activity and social movements within a black public. No other period of time has been castrated. Right, has literally been as impotent as now in terms of the intellectual resources that we have to think about how to engage white supremacy. And we've let that happen. Black journalists have let that happen. Black scholars have let that happen.
I used to love going through like Ebony, Negro Digest, Presence yep. Africaine, Black Scholar. It is amazing, like the scholarship from that period of time. It is... It is, I mean, if you were to read some of that material, not only is a lot of that scholarship relevant today, but I mean, if you juxtapose it with a lot of the content that you typically see today, it's, I'm almost speechless, just the comparison.
Exactly.
What I did.
And that's the only thing I can say, I'm speechless.
Absolutely, absolutely.
There's nothing more to say about it, because it's not even scholarship anymore, man. I look at some of the stuff that comes out in Ebony, and it's all one perspective. And it's nothing wrong if you have one perspective. So if you had a piece like on, you know, black male privilege or whatever you want, but, you know, you have another piece where people are questioning that, that's one thing. But they don't create venues for debate. They don't create venues by which people can actually discuss an issue. All they do is say this publication is now based on this point of view. And I don't see how that helps the black public. I don't see why we're trying to cultivate religious subservience rather than radical thinking.
Hang on. What you were talking in your response, you were saying how a lot of times black people who've invested their life energy in trying to create scholarship and ideas, concepts to help us solve this problem, we don't appreciate their work until after they're deceased. And I was thinking of one notable exception, and same thing that you just said. I'm not hating. And it's not even just me. Ta-Nehisi Coates, he's on the president's book reading list. He's got nominations for national book awards and all kinds of other prizes. And I see him interviewed almost every other day. And I said, wow, that's incredible. Like, I don't see any other black scholar being, you know, worshipped while they're alive in this sort of manner. That's kind of an anomaly. And he was at the Schomburg Center within the last 30 days. And he got asked that very question. They said, why do you think white people are so into your work? And there was kind of like an ooh in the crowd, like, whoa, maybe you weren't supposed to ask that question. And he was kind of saying, well, I try to be respectful of my audience and keep in mind that white people are going to read my work and that I'm not trying to attack them personally, but just presenting factual information with, you know, exactly. That they can learn and blah, blah, blah. And it's a very interesting response. It's online. You can see the video and listen for the gasp in the crowd when the question is asked. I will pitch to you, why do you think white people are so enamored with Mr. Coates' work?
Well, I think Coates has a unique voice. I think that he is competent enough in the academic literature that he appeals to black academics. So when his book came out, all these academics rushed to get it and make commentaries on it, right? And I didn't because I was like, you know, I'll read it at some point, but it's not an academic work in that way that I'm going to put down my research for to engage. The other thing is I think that he speaks with a certain kind of moderateness, right? So when you think about his work, even the piece that he really blew up for in the Atlantic on reparations, it's not a radical engagement with the history of reparations such that it calls for a destruction of the economic foundations of the United States. It's in the call for the incorporation
of black people such that they get what they're owed so that they can truly kind of repair the history of America. So it's that kind of liberal, moderate position that is going to allow white people an end to his perspective and his work, right? And I think that you see this even by the reactions to his book. So in a lot of reviews, they're like, oh, it's too pessimistic, right? It doesn't have this notion of hope that allows us to repair the American democracy. And then I thought about that, and I was like, well, I don't know what that means. Right? Unless you believe that it is the responsibility of black people to offer hope for white people, or even hope for other black people rather than present reality, then I don't see that as a work of scholarship. And if you say that that's in fact their role, then you're saying that they have a role to propagandize what they actually write. So we're not writing things to actually communicate, we're just writing propaganda to give black people hope despite this kind of perilous situation. And either one of those, I think Coates has an audience. And I think that it's the expectation both of the liberal academic who wants hope and the moderate white person that wants to believe that America could be saved that he captures. And that's very different when you look at people who are prolific writers. I mean, you look at the genius of someone like, you know, Charles Mills. You look at a genius of someone like Lewis Gordon. This is not to say that Coates doesn't have his place next to them and vice versa. But it's to suggest that, look, you know, there are other positions that explain the world quite adequately that have not been engaged, right? That say that the issue with white people is precisely one of black faith or racial imperialism or white supremacy or the white polity. That simply won't be engaged, not because they're not true, but because they don't appeal to that same moderate sensibility that white people could ultimately save America. And I think that's why Coates gets the attention he gets. No hate on him. Congrats. I'm extremely happy that we have a public intellectual that at least is engaging research. But at the same time, we have to understand that everything's about positioning oneself to do certain things. Some people believe that everything should be about facts, the facts about black people. I'm actually one of those people. So that means that even when something's unpopular, I don't care. I care about whether or not the argument about black people that we're advancing is correct. Now, other people want to be recognized and rewarded for what they say about black people. That's fine, too. Right? It's not an either-or, but I think that when we look at what Coates means next to how does he advance the interests of black people, I think that becomes a much more complicated kind of conversation than why white people like him. I think it's easy to figure out what white people like him. What his work actually does to advance the interests of black people, I think that's a much more difficult conversation.
Context of White Supremacy, Dr. Tommy J. Curry. I wanted to make sure I got back as well to the situation at Notre Dame. Because we were talking about that this weekend, and I was telling folks there were so many things happening. It was, I mean, which is genuinely the case with racism, but there were so many things happening, it was difficult to keep up. And I thought that was really important, the situation that happened last week, where this black male student came out and saying that this white woman was trying to coerce him into having sexual intercourse with her daughter and making racist comments about his genitalia. And you know, I think this was happening. He was saying that, alleging that this happened with other black students as well. And the Young Turks, they were talking about this piece. There was on a few other outlets as well. But when they talked about it, it was presented in a really joking manner. Like, is this really mistreatment? Like this white woman who, you know, is saying, hey, you've got a large penis and my daughter's hot. You should check her out. Like, is that really abuse? Like, and they repeated that over and over again. Like, I don't really think that's racist if you tell a black person that he has a large penis. And I thought, wow, like like you were saying earlier, if we flip this around. So if this is a black male doing this to a white student, if it's a black female teacher that's doing this to a white student, would we be talking about this in the same way? And I just said there's no conceptualization at all that this black person could be, this black male could be a victim of sexual violence from this white woman. And I mean, it was amazing. And even not even seeing that much attention, I just wanted to get your response to that as well.
No, I think this is what happens in our society. We ignore that white women have raped black men throughout history, slavery, Jim Crow, etc. We ignore that right now white women continue to rape black boys. Like I said, I mean, you know, it's really illuminating once you've completed a manuscript on black men and boys and sexual violence that you just see how many cases, how many individual stories are related to,
the rape of these male bodies. And this was just another case of how society is not willing to see women generally, but white women specifically, as rapists next to black males. I mean, this academic teacher forced a young black man to have sex with her daughter, had him report on the sexual experience, right? You know, describes his genitalia in different ways, incentivized him by saying that if you didn't do this, I'd ultimately get you kicked out of school, right? All this stuff, this is what this young man is dealing with, because this is the academic tutor. So people don't see that as coercion. I mean, I've constantly mentioned to people on different social media fronts that, you know, one of the aspects of rape where females are perpetrators is that men are made to penetrate, right? Boys are made to penetrate. And this is a very clear case where he was made to penetrate the daughter of the white woman for her enjoyment and for the daughter's enjoyment. And, you know, this has a very long history in fetishizing black male bodies, has a very long historical pattern of white women sexually abusing and coercing black men into sexual activities against their will. And it also has a very long legacy of society choosing not to believe that black men can actually be victims of sexual assault and rape. And all three of those things point to the fact that black male bodies and black male life are ultimately dehumanized, because we will, and again, I say this about the black academic class as well, we refuse to see those bodies as vulnerable in a sexual register. We simply will not see those black males as being possibly victimized by white women or women generally. And none of the data that we have, be it in bidirectional violence, in sexual abuse of black boys, you know, we've recently finished the study, I think I mentioned last time, that was interviewing black males who had experienced rape at a young age, and the stories are amazing. It's so heartbreaking to hear stories where black boys are made to watch sexual activities by older black women, where black boys are forcibly raped by older black women, where older black women have fellatio, forced them to have cunnilingus with them, you know, and we have all these abuse stories of white women fetishizing them, white women telling them these stories about their genitalia. This is a very, very real thing. And black men, because they experience this and nobody knows about it, they don't hear about it, have to suffer this alone. I mean, because imagine how many other students at Notre Dame, black male students at Notre Dame, may have had this happen to them and didn't come forward, right? This is a problem. This is a problem. And then when black men have these other problems later on in life, be expressed through things like rape or deviance or criminality or violence or trauma or even, you know, domestic abuse of women, people say, oh, black men, black masculinity is the problem, instead of understanding that it's the trauma that keeps happening to black men and boys that society ignores that creates these issues. You can't rape somebody and then be like, well, that's not going to cause any effect. And as you say, that would never happen to a female. That would never happen to a female body, right? We're hyper sensitive to rape in a female. Like, any words we say is identified with rape culture. Whereas black males are actually victims of rape by white women, black women, and even other men, and we act like, well, it's just not happening. Right? These are real problems. There's a real blindness. And this isn't about identity politics. It's about damn numbers. Like, we can point to the stories. We can point to the people that are coming into the hospital that are being sexually assaulted. It's like Deion Payne. We have a case where he was anally penetrated by two white men, and they refused to call that rape. Like, what else has to happen? Right? What else has to happen for black men, for a society to accept that males could be raped? Right, I just don't understand. You know what I mean?
I don't understand. What terms or phraseology did they think qualified for that if it was not rape?
They just refused in the Deion Payne case.
Yes, sir.
No, they just refused. They convicted them of, I think, second degree murder, but they wouldn't convict them on rape charges. They wouldn't charge them with rape.
Wow.
And this, you know, this is a major aspect of the book. But we see the same thing with Stop and Frisk. Black men are constantly penetrated anally with batons, screwdrivers, right? You know, we see this in Chicago a lot. A lot of cases come from Chicago. A lot of urban areas. Quite a few cases in New York. We see this a lot. And, you know, I remember even being in situations with white women when I was growing up and constant sexual references, right? It's just amazing. It's just amazing how these things happen.
And there's simply no conversation about it. And the most heartbreaking thing, Gus, is that even amongst black scholars, there's no scholarship about it, right? So it's not like the public is misinformed. We have the scholarship to kind of challenge, you know, misperception. There's a wholehearted belief, even amongst scholars who research things like race and gender, that black men simply can't be raped. I've been told this, given my work, that, well, I don't see how black men could be raped. Black men always want sex. Well, if you have that view that black men always want sex, then you will never see them as victims. In fact, even when they're victimized, you probably see them as a perpetrator or consenting.
Wow.
Yeah.
Context of white supremacy. I wanted to make sure I got it as well before we didn't take up your whole evening, but you encouraged us to get Todd Couch on the program before, and he gave great work in terms of these young white men being in these gun clubs and going out and shooting and what have you. I was even connecting that with some of these reports about the death rates for middle-aged whites and even what we were talking about violence, even it being a rite of passage for white masculinity, doing violence against black bodies. I was even thinking if his work would correlate nicely with that as well.
Oh, yeah, Todd was a great student. He's a great student. And I think that his work actually, you know, him being a sociologist, he actually went out and tested some of the things that we discussed in class. So, you know, I'm really impressed with his work. I'm hoping that it gets published very, very soon. But you're absolutely right. I mean, and he has actual proof that, you know, kind of what we were talking about regarding black men, that a lot of these clubs see black males as being the primary justification for getting these guns, right? I mean, once you've kind of established that, given his evidence, and you kind of have this historical, you have the kind of analytic sensibilities of what's going on with black men and violence, white vigilantism, and police brutality, you know, I mean, it just requires a different level of analysis. You know, it's every time we try to have a serious conversation about this, it becomes, well, you're not talking about the right body. We want to talk about this body and that body. You know, but then you get mad when people say all lives matter, right? Like, how is that any different? You show that black men are being killed more, you say, well, they're not important, let's talk about this group. Same thing that white people do. You say that black people are getting shot, they're saying, oh, but white people get shot too. The issue isn't a competition about identity. We can both talk about black women being killed. We can talk about black gay people being killed. We can talk about black trans people being killed. But if we do have this competition where we can't analyze specific reasonings and calluses behind why black males are being shot at such a higher rate than every other group, then I just don't know what we're supposed to study. Because it means that we can't do research. We just have to agree with each other. And that doesn't help anybody, right?
Absolutely. What is the report that you did on the sexual violence against black males? I want to make sure that I can link it and check it out myself.
Which one? So there's chapters. I have a few chapters up on academia that's talking about the research, but the most of it's in the book.
Oh, okay. And the book is, you said you're 5,000 words from being done?
Yes, 5,000 words from being done. So it's a pretty long book.
Okay. Do you have an estimated like time of arrival when we can look for it?
Well, I'm hoping I'm going to send it off this semester, so I'm hoping that it'll be, if all the reviews go well, it'll be out by the mid of next year.
Okay.
So that's what I'm at, mid 2016. That's what I'm hoping.
Okay, we will definitely be on the lookout. I'm looking at your page on academia.edu right now. See if I can find the most recent one that's dealing with. Is it the crisis of the unheard, state violence, black bodies, and Martin Luther King's black power? Is that one of them?
No. I recently did a piece on phobiogenesis. So I think the title's called This Nigger's Broken.
Oh, I see it.
Yeah, and that actually deals with a piece, the McDowell case, the brother who was executed in the wheelchair. And I actually ask, why is that even black disabled men are still seen as dangerous and threats, even if they have physical disabilities that prevent them from being so? You know, the other piece is Eschatological Dilemmas, really talks about some of the very same things we're talking about, the rapes of black men by cops throughout 2012, 2013, especially that case in Joliet where four whites that had an orgy on top of the two brothers, Rankin. that, you know, so, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff, man. There's, you know, and actually it gets kind of difficult sometimes because, you know, you do this research and it's not like you're just playing with theory, but you're actually trying to give accounts and theories for why black people are dying in the real world, you know. And it becomes almost depressing to not only see that this happens to black males in society, but also that amongst other black people in the academy, there's just such disdain and hate towards black men and boys that it's unbelievable. You know, it's unbelievable. And you have to really think sometimes whether or not the scholarship even matters, because when you try to show that black men and boys matter to black families, that they matter to, you know, the economic and, you know, psychological conditions of black women and girls, that's just not a conversation that many people are having today, you know?
Mm.
So it was an uphill battle.
Appreciate the honesty. I'm going to post this on Facebook so folks can check it out. And by the time you visit with us again, I will have read it, so we'll have some questions. Well, I guess hopefully we'll have you back before the book comes out. But
definitely to
chat on this. And I know folks will be looking forward for the book. It is always a pleasure to have you on the program, Dr. Curry. Really appreciate
it. I'm humbled by the invitation.
It is. I know tons of folks around the world, they always look forward to hearing you on the program. So just many, many thanks. Please keep up the great work. And we will be looking forward to hearing from you again real soon, sir.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Take care.
All right.
Context of White Supremacy, Dr. Tommy J. Curry. Always a treat to have him on the program. We'll be looking forward to having him back on as soon as possible. Really great insight on a lot of things that are happening right now. I'm going to post the link for the article that he referenced at the end there, This Nigger's Broken Hyper-Masculinity, The Buck, and the Impossibility of Physical Disability in the Black Male Body. Folks want to check it out, I'll post it on Facebook. You can download it and check it out, all that good stuff. He has a lot of newer papers that he's written this year, all dealing with racism, white supremacy, but I'm definitely looking forward. Wish I had read it before the program. I could have asked a few extra questions there. I will be true to my word. Thomas in New York, if you want to explain why we need to make sure that we check out the gospel according to Mac and what that has to do with the situation in Missouri. We'll make time for that as well. Just take a quick commercial break and we will be right back. Context of white supremacy. I reckon if you have anything you want to make sure you get in from Dr. Curry, you can do that as well. But quick commercial break and we'll be right back. Context of white supremacy.
RacismDaily.com, your number one source for global news reports on race, racism, and overt actions of white supremacy. From Asia to the Americas to Europe to Australia to Africa, racism is not a thing of the past. It is our current reality. Be informed. Be globally informed. You should be the first to know. RacismDaily.com, RacismDaily.com, RacismDaily.com.
Is racism hurting you? On issues of race, are you unable to speak, think, and act with clarity and confidence? Are you tired of laughing when nothing is funny, smiling when you are not happy, agreeing when you really disagree? CounterRacism.com, you can learn specific strategies and techniques to counter the behaviors of the people who practice racism in all areas of activity. Using words correctly, following counter-racist logic, even counter-racist science projects designed to reveal what racism is, how it works, and how to counter it. The open source code writing format allows you to pick and choose from a variety of counter-racist suggestions so you can produce the code that works for you. Stop by counterracism.com today and help replace racism with justice.
That's counter-racism.com.
Context of white supremacy. We should be back minimum Friday. Book study session, Gary Rivlin, Katrina, After the Flood. We have two sessions left and we'll be all done moving on to the next book. Looking forward to addressing that, but that's Friday. Thomas in New York, if you are with us, press star 6 so we can get your hand in if you want to explain the significance of the Gospel According to Mac and how that relates to the situation in Missouri. And we can proceed. If he disconnected, I guess we could do it this weekend for the compensatory call-in. I thought he was still hanging out, but if he is not... Oh, there he is. All right, Thomas in New York, did you want to give us the Gospel According to Mac, how that relates to the situation in Missouri? You should be with us, sir. Let's see. All right, there we go. Are you there? Or I don't know if you're in a spot where you can talk. Are you with us, Thomas in New York? Might not be in a space where he can talk presently. If not, we can get that over the weekend. I would encourage folks to check it out because it's all about racism. It's an ESPN 30 for 30 documentary all about racism at the campus of the University of Colorado at Boulder. It's during the program during like the 1980s. It is... deals with some of the very issues that we talked about on the program today. With that, I will go ahead and wrap things up because we've been active. We will certainly have time on the weekend program, compensatory call-in, to talk about the myriad of issues that have been going on this week and catch up on the Holtzclaw trial as well. This Sunday is our once-a-month early broadcast, the morning program, 12 noon Pacific, 11 a.m. Central, 9 a.m. Pacific, this Sunday, the early broadcast. So for folks looking to tune in bright and early, we should have other opportunity to discuss and hopefully some participation from our listeners outside the U.S. With that, I hope folks enjoyed it, got some constructive info. Always great to have Dr. Curry on the program. I'm going to post the essay promptly, and the program should be available. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, lots of places where you can download the content. Of course, you can just get it right at Black Talk Radio Network. Should be available for download and live streaming there as well. Just give it about an hour after the live program concludes. Drop an email if you have any problems, find anything in the archives or downloading something. You can't locate a program, let me know and we'll hop on that. With that, invest if you think the program is constructive, listener supported, counter racist radio. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop me an email and we'll get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested over the years and kept us on the air. Hope the Cows has and continues to provide constructive information on what racism, white supremacy is, how it works, and what it means to be white. That's it. Thanks again, and thanks to all the folks who called in. Great to get your questions as well. We will be back soon. Way we always end the program, under conditions of white terrorism, sobriety would be best. Someone sent me an article today where a black person was under the influence and white race soldiers used that as pretext to commit all sorts of violence against them. That's going to happen anyway under the system of white supremacy. Again, this is just about minimizing the likelihood of it happening to you, doing everything you can, we can, so that we can be thinking clearly and making the best possible decisions to protect ourselves and other folks that we're responsible for. If you're going to be behind the wheel, passenger, even a pedestrian, sobriety would be best. You never know when Daniel Holtzclaw could be lurking around the corner. Buckle up as well. Very easy. Again, just about minimizing. We don't want to have silly stuff causing us unnecessary problems and wasting time. Certainly be mindful about being around white people that are intoxicated, extremely dangerous. Do everything you can to avoid that. And even non-white people that are under the influence, you really want to be cautious about that. Just a lot of times it's a recipe for easily avoidable conflict. Preserve your time and energy. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. Black journalism, hugely important to eliminating racism, white supremacy. It has been time. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.